Good afternoon, colleagues. This is the September 23rd Finance and Economic Resiliency Committee meeting. I'm joined by my colleagues, Vice Chair Commissioner Richardson and Vice Mayor Commissioner Samulin. I don't have any requests for deferrals. Anybody want to announce a deferral or withdrawal of an item? No? Okay. I got a request to hear item 7 first. Who wants to tee that up? This is
bring over this guy.
Sorry? This is a discussion regarding negotiations pursuant to an ITN regarding Collins Park Artistic Workforce Housing Project. Eric, are you going to do this?
Commissioner, I'm going to be part of the team presenting on this, along with Rafael and Justin Carr from Economic Development. So I see Justin is joining the panel. Justin, okay. You want to kick us off?
You guys wanted to hear this first, correct?
That would be awesome.
Okay, let's go. Justin, are you going to kick us off?
Yes, sir. Can you hear me all right?
Yep, please go ahead.
Okay, so as you all know, this project has been in the works for a couple of years. It's coming from the city's goal to promote workforce housing on our assets. And pursuant to the direction of the committee, we've been negotiating with Servitas for the last few months, and their proposal has come a long way, and we're confident in its development. We just would like to get some feedback from you and direction on certain policy questions. The memo laid it out pretty well, what the project looks like. You know, they're proposing a 7-story building, ground floor space that's open to programming. The second floor is going to be a dormitory for the use of the Miami City Ballet. And then above that on the 5 floors is about 80 units of workforce housing. So as this deal is structured, it's quite unique for us. It's a long-term lease, 50 plus 220s, with a nonprofit that's not the developer. So we'd enter into this lease with a nonprofit that's going to completely finance the project using bond funding with limited involvement from the city as far as financial investment up front. And then a long-term ground lessee would be responsible for the project, and an asset manager would be Servitas, and I think they're in discussions with Pinnacle to do property management. But as it's contemplated right now, there's limited financial involvement from us up at the front end, and as well as during operation of the project. In fact, there's going to be some revenues, surplus revenues, that we're going to seek your direction on how to use. So that's the first issue of policy that we would like to, you know, get some feedback from. As it serves to stand right now, the developer thinks that in the year 3, there'll be about $300,000 worth of surplus revenue coming off from the rental revenues. And they're proposing perhaps that the ballet would use that money to offset some of its costs for revenue. You know, there's the administration would like perhaps that we would also be a beneficiary to use some of that money, perhaps to activate the ground floor with cultural programming or to offset costs for the residents upstairs. And to that end, we're looking to firm up commitment from the ballet for their long-term involvement in the project, you know, pursuant to a master sublease. And in the event that the ballet is going to, for any reason, have to leave the project, their dormitory floor is convertible to housing units. So, you know, we'd want to just make sure that any costs related to that are taken care of. So along with the cost of the project, you know, I said that there's limited costs for the city. There could be some site preparation costs related to environmental remediation. So Servitas has proposed a structure where, you know, they're going to obtain all the reports. They'd be responsible for a cost up to $20,000 with, you know, our input, of course. And then after that, the city would be responsible up to a maximum city contribution of $200,000. And after that point, the city would have the right to terminate the development agreement if it was going to exceed those costs. So we're hoping to get your input on that, if that's okay. Also important is the ground floor programming, what we could do there. Servitas is very open to working with us regarding what goes on. You know, it could be some artist cultural programming that's in line with the overlying district, or it could be revenue that support commercial retail that provides revenue to support the project. But either way, the ground floor has to provide some sort of revenue for the project, whether it's from the city paying or from retail tenants, in order to make their pro forma work out. Please feel free to stop me at any point. I'm just going to try to get through these.
Dustin, thank you. I was just about to stop you there because I think you jumped from, you know, one policy question to another. So okay. If you want to just sort of, however you want to backtrack. Do this in terms of, you know, go through the whole gamut of issues that we need to discuss and then go back and we can go one by one, or do you want to stop after each one? Do you want to finish painting the picture?
Whatever your preference is, sir.
I mean, it just seems like you know where you want to go with this. So please continue and finish up. Eric, were you going to say something?
Yeah, I think there's only really seven issues. And so
only seven?
I think it might be worthwhile for Justin to walk through the seven and then we'll backtrack and take them one by one.
Yeah, that's what I would recommend to it. To me, it's usually helpful to see the entire picture and then go back one by one rather than try to make decisions without seeing the whole picture. But only seven, huh, Eric? You couldn't make this any easier on us?
I'm at four, so we're getting through them. I'm trying to be quick.
Justin, was that one that you mentioned? Because I heard two or three different things in there. Was that one or is that two or three that you mentioned?
I mentioned, I think, three. You know, the use of the revenues, environmental remediation, and ground floor programming. That's three.
Right. Okay.
Next would be sort of like the allocation of risk before financial closing of the project. So they, Zuritas proposes that up to the HPB approval, if there's any unforeseeable conditions that stop the project from happening, that the city would be responsible for all of those pre-closing expenses, approximately $280,000, plus a portion of their development fee that would have been earned up to that point. So that's another additional 387, so a total of 667 up to HPB approval. And then if after HPB approval, but before financial closing, if there's a, for any reason the project doesn't proceed, they propose that we would be responsible for all pre-closing expenses of $1.3 million. So, you know, the city understands that this is a very good deal for us in the fact that they're offering to give us the whole upside of the project, you know, the revenues. Normally when we negotiate P3 projects or prior development, you know, the risk is on the developer, but here it's shifted because they're offering to give us all of the upside of the project in the form of rental revenues or up to our disposition, however the commission decides to do that. So we are open to this. We would just like to perhaps see some sort of cap on that type of the risk and our monetary exposure beforehand. So I'm just going to move along to the fifth item, which was they've requested to waive all fees that are associated with the project, you know, the city's regulatory fees. It's really by ordinance, we don't allow that. It would require a change to our LDRs and any other in the city code, except that there is a waiver of the technology and training fee that's going through the commission. Last week, the commission voted favorably upon first reading, so that's one thing that would be permitted. Next, they're asking for GU waivers to make the project feasible. We're very much in support of these. It's just unit size and then waiver of parking associated with the project. That's very much in line with the commission's incentives that they codified a few years ago to incentivize workforce housing, you know, density in the form of unit size and parking waivers. So we think that these are things that the administration can back. And then finally, the seventh issue is just an issue when this project came out, the commission said that they wanted the workforce residents to be teachers and educators. Teachers are educators, but teachers and artists, people who work in the arts and cultural business. And we think we're confident that they'll be able to lease up the space with those type of tenants, but in the event that for some reason they can't, service has asked for like a waterfall list of tenants, different types of workforce residents who could use the space. And we've provided them in the memo, you know, nurses, law enforcement, emergency service providers, and other income eligible people. Everyone has to fall within the workforce housing AMI criteria that's in our code. So that's the last policy issue that we seek your direction on. And I know that Servitas is here today. They're willing to answer some questions. And so are Eric and Raphael. That's it.
Great job, Justin. Thank you. What I'd like to do, I'll try to reframe it for everyone. But colleagues, do you have any questions? I know Commissioner Samuelin, you were around through parts of this at least, and Commissioner Richardson, a lot of this had to do before you joined, so I don't know how up to speed necessarily you are, but
it seems like the big ticket item, Mr. Chair, is the fourth item. So if we could hear from the administration more on that item, the other issues seem much smaller in comparison policy wise, but number four seems to be the big ticket item. So if we could get more comments on that, that seems to me the big dollar.
Yeah. I mean, so what I was going to say, you know, for members of the public who are watching to understand what we're doing here is that we have city-owned property in the Collins Park neighborhood. And several years ago, in our efforts to provide for workforce housing, and then in this particular case, try to target some housing for our artist community, potentially with Miami City Ballet, we put out RFPs for P3 public-private partnership. We got responses for that. Selected firm Servitas, who we may hear from shortly, and they're going to largely build this on their own dime, and we're going to have delivered to us a project in the Collins Park neighborhood that is workforce housing, which means you know, it's a defined term, but for artists and for working members of our community, such as teachers. What is being asked today of us are certain waivers and potentially shifting some risk to the city in the event that the project, for whatever reason, doesn't get completed or doesn't go forward. So then that's what we're going to be spending most of our time digging into. Eric, in a nutshell, high level, I got it?
You got it. Spot on.
Okay. Yeah.
We think we're really close as far as the terms, and we just want to make sure that the finance committee is read in on this, and we're getting your input into some of these more nuanced terms of the agreement.
So the question I have, and maybe the representative from Servitas would like to address it. Assuming we're going to move forward with this, we're being asked to potentially shift some risk from this developer to the city. I'd like to hear, Eric, from you or from Servitas, why might that eventuality happen? Because what I want to do is understand the risk, because we're going to make a decision on whether we want to assume that risk or not. What are those risks in reality? What probability does a city have in assuming those risks? Are they minimal, or is it probable that some of these things might happen? Because that might make our decision easier if we had a better sense of what those risks actually are.
Let me start that off, and then I'll kick it to Rafael, because he'll probably be able to add a lot more value to some of my statements. But I think Justin kind of framed it properly, that this is a very different project than what we're used to considering, because it's really a not-for-profit entity that is just building and managing the building on our behalf, and will be revenue sharing basically with us and the ballet whatever money is thrown off from the end result. And so their concern is, because they're not benefiting on the back end, that if this project doesn't get built and they don't earn their development fee, which is really their only compensation for this, that they've wasted a lot of time and effort at our request without any value coming to them. I see this as a two-pronged discussion. One is, pre-HPB approval, where I think that there's a lot more due diligence and working out of details that they've got to do and make sure that it all works financially and that HPB doesn't have some requirements that get put on it that change the dynamics of the deal. And then post HPB, it becomes a very, you know, normal building permit process. And from my perspective, a lot of the due diligence should have been wrapped up by that point, and the risk becomes much less. And ultimately, from my perspective, should shift from the city to the developer. But Rafael, you want to add?
No, that's absolutely right. That the risks are in the early stages of the project, and you know, prior to HPB approval, until you have a final non-appealable HPB order, there is a risk that a resident in the neighborhood could challenge the project. Just like with any development, there's always that risk. So the issue of the reimbursement of those expenses that are incurred up to that point, it's a fair one to address in this context of what is ultimately a nonprofit deal, where you're serving workforce housing goals of the city, and the city receiving or designees of the city, such as Miami City Ballet, receiving up to 100% of the proceeds of the project. So, but in terms of your question, Commissioner, what are the risks? It's a challenge to the project ultimately, or costs that, like environmental expenses that were not foreseen.
Yeah, well, remediation expenses is one of the ones that that I had. I have my own sense of how it might go with HPB, and we'll discuss that. What I don't have a sense of is, you know, environmental remediation, you know, what's on the site, and, you know, is this a real risk that might kill the project? We've seen it in some other cases like parks, where we get surprised at how expensive remediation can be. So, you know, again, helping us all understand the risk, but you did a nice job of outlining the HPB. Colleagues, you want to weigh in on anything, or we just proceed? Mark or David, you want to? Yep.
So
weigh in on the HPB question. Because
go ahead, Mark.
Oh, I was just to say, Mr. Chair, I know Commissioner Richardson wanted to focus on number four. I actually think if we could just maybe take it one by one. I think there are seven of them. I'd like to just each item, let's weigh in and do it.
Okay.
I think that's a good idea. Let's just go one by one by one. We'll knock them all out.
All right. That's fine. Yeah, because I'd like to discuss amongst us HPB and how much of a risk do we think that might be that it wouldn't be approved there. I mean, I kind of have a gut feeling for it, but that's what I'd like to talk to you guys about. But if you guys want to go one by one, that's fine. Eric, Jason, Justin, do you want to walk us through each one?
Sure. So the first item is really the meat and potatoes of the discussion from my perspective. It's the revenue that's going to be generated off of the building long term. How is that revenue going to be split? Some of the discussions that we've had is that the city's upfront cost, whether that be environmental remediation or any other upfront development fees, should be the first things that get reimbursed. The city should be made whole first and foremost. Once that's in place, then we've got, you know, this concept of a long-term rental agreement with Miami City Ballet, which is going to be helpful when we go to the financing market to get more favorable financing terms. We're willing to work with the ballet to try and get them made whole for, you know, their long-term lease on a year-by-year basis. If we make enough money to cover the cost of them renting the dormitory space, then we feel like the city should be the beneficiary of anything that's left over. And ultimately, you know, maybe some of that goes towards the city leasing the ground floor and programming it as we see fit. Just my thoughts.
Anyone for the ballet here that wants to speak on that? Okay. Okay, I see some hands from the Miami City Ballet, and I see Michael Llorente, who represents them. And Marcia Duprat. Michael, do you want to go first?
Sure, Mr. Chair, do you hear me?
Yes.
Great, thank you. And thanks for the opportunity to speak, Mr. Chair, Commissioners, Mike Llorente, Llorente Heckler, on behalf of the Miami City Ballet. As you all know, when this proposal was put together, it was put together with the goal of partially or fully subsidizing the housing expense for the ballet. The way that we've proposed to structure this deal is that the first, I guess, tranche or the first bucket of excess cash flow coming from the deal after the city's, any city costs are covered, obviously, as Eric mentioned, number one is to make sure the city is completely whole. Following that, our proposal would be that the surplus cash be used to fully subsidize the Miami City Ballet's housing costs. Our pro formas, Servitas's pro formas, show that that should happen around year three or year four. After year three or year four, there should be enough revenue coming from the project to subsidize not only the City Ballet, the Miami City Ballet, for its housing costs, but to start subsidizing the ground floor cultural tenant. And by year, I think it's year seven or eight, there should be an additional $150,000 of annual cash flow coming from the project that would be used by the city to subsidize the cultural tenant on the ground floor fully and in perpetuity. So the way that we've sort of at least conceptually structured the deal, within the first 3 or 4 years, the Miami City Ballet would have the ability to occupy one dormitory floor at essentially no cost. They would pay, but then be reimbursed with the proceeds. And then a few years later, by year seven or eight, there would be additional revenue flowing to the city to be able to offer that ground floor space to a cultural tenant of its choosing at no cost, not in perpetuity, but for the duration of this project. Year seven or eight, there should be additional revenue flowing from the deal, which would presumably go to the city. So it's sort of like a waterfall, you know, of beneficiaries from the cash flow. That's conceptually how we have it structured and are proposing it to you.
Okay. Here's somebody from the Miami New Drama, Nick Richburg. Are you here for this item? Your hands up. Nick?
Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Yeah, good afternoon. I'm Nick Richburg, Managing Director of Miami Drama. As potential future neighbors across the street at the Collins Park Garage, we just wanted to say that we're extremely supportive of this project and of Miami City Ballet as a principal tenant of the space. We know all too well the challenges of artist housing on the beach. Even though our last season was cut short by 4 months, we housed nearly 50 artists for over 1,500 nights at a cost of over $160,000, and that should have been much more. The housing requirements of our union, as well as short-term rental ordinances, make the process very difficult. So a large portion of the housing is forced off the beach, meaning that visiting artists are shopping, eating, and living off Miami Beach and spending tens of thousands of dollars in hired cars and fossil fuels getting back and forth. So we applaud the project, and we strongly support Miami City Ballet as the primary tenant. We would also welcome the opportunity to add this item to our ongoing discussions with staff about our presence at Collins Park to see if Miami New Drama can be included in some kind of meaningful capacity and bring our artists back to the beach as well.
Thank you for that.
Thanks.
All right, I think Marcia Duprat is, your hand is up, but I think you're here for item eight, right? Okay, hands down. Okay, let's bring it back to the dais. Commissioner Samuel, your hand's up.
Yep, thank you, Mr. Chair. I raised my hand as I heard Eric describe it. It sounded like we would first make sure the city was whole, Then we were going to make sure that the Miami Ballet was whole. By the way, this is all very exciting how it's coming together. So this is great to have this conversation. And that the city would then be the recipient for the incremental funds after. That's sort of what I took away. We'd be whole, they'd be whole, and the city gets it back. So I was raising my hand because that sounds conceptually right. I heard what Mr. Llorente said. So if there's any other nuance you need us to weigh in on, let us know. But what you described, Eric, made sense to me.
Yeah. Question for Eric, and I think Commissioner Samuelin summarized it the same way I'm understanding it in terms of, you know, recouping costs and then splitting it, which is a decision point. The other decision point is we have to confirm that we want Miami City Ballet to be that other partner with us, as opposed to another entity, whether it's Miami New Drama or the Bass Museum or other ones, correct? I mean, it's not a done deal that this with Miami City Ballet, although that's, you know, I think where I'm inclined, but I just want to make sure that we don't miss a data point, which is Miami City Ballet right now is what's in the proposal. But do we have to do it with Miami City Ballet or no?
So here's how we've structured it, at least to this point. Miami City Ballet would be a master leaseholder for the second floor and would enter into a long-term lease agreement, at least conceptually. They still have to get buy-in from their board. But they would be a master leaseholder in the second floor and would have a long-term lease agreement for the dormitory. The first floor, what we've worked in is the city would have a right of first refusal to lease that first floor space. And then if we lease that first floor space, you know, that ultimately doesn't happen until the building is built out. And at that point in time, we would make a decision as to how we would utilize that first floor space. The Miami City Ballet is obviously asking for, you know, they want first dibs on it, but at least right now, the agreement doesn't contemplate how the space would be used. The city would have a right of first refusal and then would assign the space based on the needs at that time.
But we would control, the city would control the ground floor lease as to who the tenant would be, right?
We would have a right of first refusal because the revenue associated with that first floor is critical to making the overall pro forma work. And so the city would have to lease the building, that first floor, at market rate. We're anticipating that is somewhere between $100,000 and $150,000 annually.
So that's important, Eric, because that's different than what we're contemplating doing in the garage, which would be below market rate.
Right. In the garage space, we own the property outright. And all we're really talking about is the build out and the ultimate tenants.
Okay. So yeah, in order to make all this work, you're saying that the ground floor lease would have to be at market rates per the pro forma.
Correct. Now that would ultimately get subsidized over time, but at least for the first handful of years, if the city wanted to exercise that right of first refusal, we would be paying into the overall building to make the money work.
How does this play into Servitas? They're not, how are they affected by the ground floor lease, if at all?
Servitas is really a construction manager slash building manager in this layout. They are going to partner with a 501c3 not-for-profit to go to the bond market and fund the project, but they are managing the build out basically on the city's behalf, and will ultimately manage the building until the bond, throughout the term of the lease, unless, you know, they hand off that management to another agency.
Okay. So the bonds get paid off from the rental of the units. So the Miami City Ballet, second floor dormitory, Annual expected rent is $336,000, plus what we get for the other floors, plus what we get from the ground floor. That's what pays off the bonds? Okay. Correct. I got it. Okay.
And obviously, Servitas is on. Christy's here if she wants to add anything to what I've said.
But our decisions with this issue don't affect Servitas. Servitas is worried about the other items as far as if the project doesn't happen, right?
Correct.
Okay. Commissioner Richardson, your hand is up.
Thank you, Chair. So I would say, I think Commissioner Samuelin repeated it and said what Eric said. I'm okay with the first couple of steps that you mentioned, Eric, on the revenue. I would say on the revenue related to the ground floor, I heard, I don't know if it was Mr. Llorente mentioned a cultural institution or so, but we don't know that that's going to be there. So I think whatever surplus revenue after the ballet second floor would be funded, I would be in favor of that revenue coming to the city, because the city is going to have first right of refusal. So if we take the space, we're going to have to pay commercial rent. So we would want that revenue to subsidize that if we decide to take the space, or if we decide to let a cultural institution go in that space at sub commercial rates, then the city's going to be on the hook for subsidizing that. So I think that revenue has to come back to the city. And I think you said that, Commissioner Samuel, and I think that you mentioned that. I think that's my view on that.
Because that ground floor lease is important rent wise, because that's what is used to pay off the debt. So if we exactly subsidize it, then the city's going to have to make up the difference.
That's exactly right. So whatever excess revenue is coming, I think it should come back to the city, and then the city can make the decision about what needs to be there. I'm going to have, you know, when this thing is built, I'm going to have the same position that I have on the ground floor of the garage next door, in that there's got to be activation, because that's a real problem with this community at night, is that it is dead at night. And to the point where I think sometimes it's unsafe. So we need activation. But yeah, that's my view on on the revenue flow.
Yeah. Commissioner Samuel?
Yeah, I just wanted to underline that I agree with that. That is my position, that ground floor flow back to the city.
Okay. I just see Nick Richburg's hand from the Miami New Drama is up. You already spoke. Is there something you want to add?
No, I'm sorry. I lowered my hand. Okay. I think it's been covered well. Thank you.
Great. Okay. Okay. Eric, do you have a direction then from us on item number one?
Very clear. Thank you.
Okay. Let's move on to item number two, which is exactly the same.
We actually already covered number two, yep, which is use of the ground floor space.
We banged out number one and two.
Well, I thought we had a question of environmental remediation. Is that a dollar?
That was number three.
That's number three.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
So I had environmental number two and ground floor programming number three. So I had them in the wrong. Okay. So
items number one and two, we covered, Eric?
Correct.
Okay, so who's going to do item number three? This was one of my concerns on remediation. We have some estimates here. My concern is if we're wrong on our estimates, because I know from doing this with our parks, we tend to underestimate how expensive those can be. So what's the risk here?
So the risk here is we've gone back and we've looked at the environmental phase one for this site. Unlike the garage site across the street, where there were several fueling stations and car mechanics over the years that ultimately ended up in approximately $500,000 in environmental cleanup costs, this one was basically a hotel during its useful lifetime until it became a parking lot. And so we don't see it as being nearly the environmental challenge that we had across the street. But we do realize that unfortunately, because we're an urban infill area, there are environmental issues on just about every site. So, you know, the $20,000 is enough to cover an environmental phase one and phase two assessment, which would have to be done on just about every site. But what Servitas wanted to do was to quantify their risk as it pertains to any additional cleanup that's required. This is going to be a little bit more challenging because it's a residential property as opposed to a purely commercial property. But we do think that because, you know, the entire site is going to be capped, that we could come to some, you know, conclusion on the environmental relatively quickly.
Okay. So in reading the memo, Servitas is going to, you know, be on the hook for the first 20 grand, which is basically to get the reports going. So we'll blow through that quickly. We then are on the hook per this proposal up to 200,000. And if it goes beyond 200,000, then we have the right to terminate the development agreement. If we do that, then it triggers some other things that we'll get to, such as, you know, whether it's item number four, if after we do all these assessments, if it's like the property across the street that was 500,000, we would then have to make a decision whether we wanted to move forward or not, right?
Correct.
Okay.
And Commissioner, with the understanding that those expenses would be reimbursed either at the financial closing, if there's enough bandwidth with the bond issuance to ultimately finance those expenses, or we would be paid from the proceeds first prior to the split that you just covered with the ballet.
Okay. I got to think about it, but okay. Colleagues, yeah. I don't know which one of you had your hand up first, so I'll just go who shows up first. Commissioner Samuelin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I want to ask two specifics around this. Assuming the project moves forward, even if we have these costs up to 200, we will ultimately be reimbursed that money. Is that correct?
Correct.
So the risk on item three is that we spend money, but ultimately the project does not move forward because then we would not recover. So we could be up to 200 if we spent the money, but that doesn't achieve it and we don't want to spend more. Is that accurate?
And not to split hairs, but it's 180 because they're covering 20, we're covering up to 200.
Nope, those 20,000 hairs are important. Thank you. Thank you for the clarification. So third question, building off of this item number three, what is the total city exposure of all the risks, the 180 plus anything else we haven't talked about? What are we potentially at risk for?
As proposed, Commissioner, then that ultimately it's those environmental expenses, whatever's incurred. And to answer your question, it depends on when that termination would happen. If it happens prior to HPB approval, then we've outlined the maximum exposure. It's on page 16 of the memo of $667,000 plus the environmental expenses incurred to date. If it's much later in the project, where they've spent more, you know, funds to develop the project, then potentially you're looking at $1.3 million exposure plus the environmental costs. So not to get ahead on that number four, but, you know, obviously it's that second piece that we're most concerned about because it involves, you know, the greatest liability exposure for the city.
Yeah, I guess my perspective on number three is that in and of itself, you know, I'm comfortable with what's on the table because it's capped. But when I start hearing $750,000 to $1.4 million, I think once we go through each item, I'd like to step back and look at the overall risk profile. But on number three, you know, tentatively, I'm okay with what I'm hearing.
Commissioner Richardson.
Thank you, Chair. I'm okay with the way this has been outlined and presented. So, you know, we could be out up to 180,000, but if we decide to move forward, we're going to get all of our costs back. We already know the garage next door had much greater issues, and that was around 500,000. I think, Eric, you said this is going to be capped, and there's no underground parking on this, so they're not going to go deep on this. So I'm comfortable with this. The greatest exposure it seems that we have if we move forward is that if the number ends up being more than 200,000 and we spend that, we're going to get that money back, which will delay and push out any benefit we would get from the ground floor lease. So that seems to me would be our biggest exposure. So I'm okay moving forward as described here.
Yeah, good summary. And I had the same sort of thought and hesitation that Commissioner Samulin was having. It sounds okay moving forward, because whether it's this project or another project, you know, we're still going to have this issue of remediation costs. And I think this project is as good of a public benefit as we can, you know, come up with. So I'd be definitely supportive of incurring this risk because it's capped, and it's risk that we would have to face on any project on this property. So, okay, we'll move forward on this. Eric, you okay?
Yep.
All right, so the bigger one is item number 4.
Correct.
Okay. Who wants to summarize what this risk would look like? I mean, basically the concern is as Civitas moves forward with the project, you know, pre-going before HPB, they're incurring a lot of costs. They get to HPB, they've got some projections here of what this would cost them to get it to HPB. HPB, for some reason, doesn't give them an approval. The project, therefore, could tentatively be terminated. And then the question is, who's going to be on the hook for all those costs that have been incurred?
That's right, at least for that, up to that point. And then there's the question of after that point. But the risk could involve whether the project, whether you can't get a final approval, whether there are conditions that maybe are imposed by HPB that render the project, you know, economically not feasible. You described the environmental question. It could be that the cost of remediation far exceed what the city would be comfortable advancing, or what could be financed. So those things would, I think what Eric has said is that we'll know early on, you know, what the risks are and be in a better position to manage that and to manage expenses and to make the call of whether the agreement needs to be terminated. So subject to your general direction on this issue, we would continue the discussions with Civitas. And Commissioner, if I may, I know that the team, the Civitas team, has and Stephen Gonzalez, their attorney, has reached out to me to in the desire to, you know, come up with options. And I'm confident that if you give us a general direction to continue to negotiate to set, you know, better parameters on this, this has to come, you know, not only to the full commission to accept the recommendation, but we've got to go through two readings and we've got a lot of work to do. And I'm confident that we can get there. They've already reached out to you know, try to get the ball rolling. We just, you know, had other committee meetings and it couldn't happen. But.
Great. Thanks, Raphael. I mean, I think all of us may have opinions. I'd love to hear from my colleagues on this, of how we might mitigate the risk of not getting HPB approval, or, you know, they put some conditions that would make this project untenable. What might we be able to do to mitigate those risks? I mean, we saw last week the Raleigh project go forward before the HPB, and then they put some conditions on it. That developer seems to go, you know, going to move forward with that project. But if for some reason the conditions that HPB put on the Raleigh, for example, would make that economically untenable for that developer, well, that developer spent a lot of money to get it to the point that he was in front of the HPB. Same thing could happen here. How might we mitigate that risk to the city ends up not having to take on all of these costs. So that's the question I have. I have some ideas on it, but colleagues, Mark, your hand was up first.
Yeah, no, I like the question. Hopefully we'll all put our heads together. You know, I have one thought, because we have a couple steps on the journey and we don't want to slow things down, but we want to get it right. Can we perhaps send a referral to HPB for an advisory opinion to lay out some broad parameters, to describe conceptually what is being done, and ask for a non-binding advisory opinion, at least to start to surface any potential red flags, issues, to get some initial discussion. I mean, the biggest risk is to go down this path, show up in front of an independent board, and then get turned away and have spent this type of money. Let's get this in front now. That's my initial reaction to that.
I had a similar idea. I don't know if there's precedent for that. Commissioner Richardson, you're up next, and I see Daniel Serraldo's hand in the public. I'll call on you next, Daniel. Commissioner Richardson?
Thank you, Chair. So do we know, Eric, have you identified, or your team, or maybe Raphael, what you think the greatest risk might be in terms of being in front of the HPB?
Just that you really never know what's going to happen.
And Commissioner, I think that to answer that question, HPB's review is design in nature, and I'm not sure that the design is, that there is a design that's sufficiently developed for the HPB to review right now. So without...
Well, I was thinking in terms of, like, I think we know in general what the proposed height would be, for example, right? So that was the issue the chair mentioned with the recent Raleigh discussion. So we're not looking to build a skyscraper, right? So we don't anticipate there would be a height question, do we?
No, we don't anticipate a height question.
It seems to be one of the most popular questions recently is right. The height.
Well, City Commission already approved a GU waiver. I don't know if it was in 2018 or 17 for this project so that the height could be a maximum of 75 feet. So so there is a GU waiver that's already been approved by the City Commission here.
And you mentioned design, but if there was a concern on the design, we could go back with an amendment, right? I mean, that's not a design is one of those things that if you don't like this, we'll give you that. So it doesn't seem like that would kill the deal to me. I do like the idea that was mentioned about sending it for an advisory. Is there any precedent for that, or is there anything that would prohibit us from doing that?
I'm hoping maybe Nick Kalergis could get moved over. He's on the call and can maybe answer this. But I think, again, advising as to what, if there's, I don't think that there's a design right. developed That's, yet.
Yeah. I mean, height clearly is one thing that we know would trigger concern. And then obviously something that's out of, you know, sort of scale and character of the neighborhood. So, you know, presumably a very modernistic looking building, you know, would cause some heartburn among the HPB folks, considering this is a historic district. And I don't know if Servitas, someone from Servitas wants to talk about this, but this might be the kind of thing that we could do to mitigate damage up front or risk up front by saying, look, HPB typically likes buildings of this scale and this design, and this should be the envelope that you develop the apartments in and not waste a lot of time and money coming with designs that aren't going to get approved. I mean, it could be as simple as that. Nick, I think, did you want to speak?
Hi, Commissioner. Sorry about that. There's nothing prohibiting the board from, or the commission from referring the matter to the HPB, but I guess I would suggest that that either at the very least a massing study or even conceptual plans be provided so that that advisory recommendation will give staff some predictability as to what the HPB is ultimately going to decide.
Yeah. I mean, maybe it's just as simple as assigning a liaison from us with Civitas. You know, I'm thinking Debbie Tackett or somebody, just say, look, these are the kinds of projects that tend to get approved at HPB. These are the kinds that aren't, so that they don't spin their wheels and waste time. I mean, it could be this, we might be making a mountain out of a molehill. This may not be an issue, but certainly I think we should address it because, you know, we could be on the hook for hundreds of thousands or, you know, million plus dollars in expenses if this doesn't go in the right direction.
Chair, can I ask another question? And maybe Nick can tell us if for me, you know, like I said, the height is always a concern, but let's say that they get a design and they raise concerns about it. Is there anything that would prohibit us from tabling it there and reworking the design and taking it back? I mean, it's not like we just get one shot up or down, but if they raise designs as we get closer, we have an opportunity to amend the design, don't we?
That's right, Commissioner. And we see that with the HPB all the time where if the board has a number of concerns on an initial, you know, an initial design of a project, the board will continue it to give the applicant the opportunity to make changes.
Right. Thank you. So having said that, on this particular issue, I think that while we are right to be concerned, I think we have very little risk here because I think, as you said, we can have a liaison. If they express concern, we pull it back, we rework it. Height is not going to be an issue. So I think that the risk is going to be relatively manageable.
Okay.
So what are the other, there were, I think, two or three other levels of fee, like where there was a development fee that would have to be paid, there would be something else. So could we just, I just want to make sure I understand all the total amount that we'd be on the hook for.
Mark, your hand is up.
Yeah, I before we left that point, I appreciate the dialogue. I certainly hope the risks are manageable. I would just like to encourage the city staff to work with Civitas to find a point during design, as Nick highlighted, whether it's massing or conceptual, some point, not tomorrow, but some point during the process where it would make sense to do an advisory review from HPB. I see no harm in doing that.
Okay. I just see Daniel Serrato's hand has been up. Daniel, did you want to say something? PJ? Daniel Serrato's hand is up. Okay, Daniel, you're on.
Hi, yes, thank you, commissioners. I have to apologize. I actually was not following this meeting, and it's almost like there's some HPB radar when people say it. I get phone calls. So I apologize. I didn't see all of the meeting, but as far as what I saw, just so the commissioners are aware, a large part of the city is within our historic districts, including, I think, almost every single cultural institution and museum. There's a lot of extremely high quality new design. If you look at the Faena condominium that was built, even the new garage, Collins Park. Designed by Alan Schulman, cutting edge modern design within the historic district. So, unless I missed something, I don't know what makes this any different than any other design. And particularly the height is already set, so there's no sort of changing the height. I love what Mark mentioned. There is a path called the preliminary evaluation where any applicant could go before the board to share their initial plans. If you feel like you'd like to do that to reduce any risk, go for it. But I really, I just want to be very clear that HPB approves, I think, more projects than any other board in the city annually. And so, I'm sure you've heard bad things, but they do a pretty darn good job. So thank you very much.
Okay. Colleagues, what do you want to do here?
I just would, if somebody could just tell us the total dollar amount again. So I heard two or three different numbers. So could someone just walk us through again the numbers?
I would ask Rafael to confirm, but I believe the number is 1.3 million, 1.306.
Total. That was with the developer fee. I heard the number 387,000. Was that was a part of that 1.3?
No. So as proposed, if the city were to reimburse Servitas for all of their development expenses through the financial closing, in the event that there's a termination, which again, with some direction to continue to work on this, I'm sure that we could really limit this as we continue our discussions. But as proposed, the city's exposure would be 1.3 million plus whatever environmental expenses had been incurred. So conceivably 1.5 million. And after HPB approval, what is before you, they're proposing for the city to have reimbursed for expenses in the event of termination, but they would not charge the development fee that would have been earned at that point. Eric and I have expressed that on this issue, we want to continue to work with them on this because we do see it very differently in terms of who should bear the risk that a closing doesn't happen before or after that HPB approval. So I don't know that it's helpful to get your comments today, but I think we can come back to you with more information. Okay.
What was the $387,000 number that I wrote down?
I think those may be proceeds that would be generated by a certain year. Is that
that's
right,
Eric? The 387 is 40% of the development fee, which is due at the time that we get to HPB.
And what I heard is that Servitas would want that.
Yes, if we cannot get through the HPB process and get a non-appealable approval, Servitas is asking for 40% of their development fee, which is the $387,000. And we're anticipating at that point there would have been expenditures on their side for design professionals in the amount of $280,000 ballpark.
Right. Okay. But that would be part of the 1.3, right? The 1.3 was total.
1.3 is total less the environmental expenses.
Right. So I would say I like what you just said a minute ago, Rafael, and that is that you think there's more work to be done in this area. And so my direction for you would be for you guys to continue working on this so that we can reduce that $1.3 million exposure number. Okay, that would be my perspective. Keep working.
Yeah, agree. One thing to note, I believe Alan Shulman is the architect of this project that they've selected, who did the garage across the street. So Alan knows how to navigate in the things that HPB likes. So I think that also mitigates potential risk. Commissioner Samuel, and your hand is up.
Yeah. I think we're in vehement agreement, colleagues. Keep working. Work really hard to reduce that risk. And maybe Servitas and our partner, the nonprofit group, have some best practices or lessons learned of how municipalities in similar situations have reduced risk, because those numbers are pretty big.
Okay, let's keep going. That was item 4 of 7.
Just Chair, I just want to highlight just what Commissioner Samuel, those numbers are pretty big, right? So think about, Eric, you said that 387 was 40% of the total development fee for not putting a shovel in the ground. So keep working.
Yeah, I mean, this will all add up, right? Because, I mean, we're going to be on the hook for $180,000 of remediation, potentially this. So it'll add up quickly. And the last thing I think any of us want, I know none of us want, is egg in our face, spend $2 million bucks of taxpayer money and not have a project that's going to move forward. That we need to avoid that.
And we want the project. We want and we need the project.
Okay.
Thank you, Commissioner. This is what we needed from you, because we really haven't in a development agreement or a ground lease gone down this path before, because we've never had a nonprofit P3 that's been presented where the city would stand to benefit from 100% of the proceeds of the project. So we'll do what you're asking us to do. We'll absolutely come back to you with a refined deal here.
Thank you.
Okay.
All right. So there are a couple other ones here that Justin mentioned are would be unusual for us, which are waivers. You want to walk us through that, Eric or Raphael?
Number five is their request for waiver of permit fees, impact and concurrency fees. We've discussed that in front of this body and the full commission, and ultimately what we've got on second reading, I believe in October, is the outcome of those discussions. So just wanted to confirm that you're comfortable that what has passed legislatively, or hopefully will pass in October, is what should be applied to this project.
Commissioner Richardson.
So Eric, I think the item that passed on first, I think feel good that it'll pass on second. But I think when Justin was going through this, I heard additional fees in addition to the one that was a subject matter of the ordinance. So and maybe Justin or you could tell us, but I think that what I heard was a request for waiver for fees that are not included in that item that has just passed on first reading. So is that right? This is in addition to? Or would everything be covered by what we're getting ready to pass on second reading if it passes?
If I could paraphrase, I think what they've asked is that we waive everything. And what we're saying is that we will be happy to waive everything that we can waive under our current municipal code, and even the additional waiver that would be passed in October.
And do we know what the additional fees would be that are outside of this thing that's going to pass hopefully in October? Do we know what additional amount we're talking about that they would like waivers on?
Justin, did we ever run those numbers?
No, it was a general. It was a general ask, and Commissioner, you'll remember back in February when the Housing Authority requested fee waivers for projects in North Beach. This committee reviewed all of the applicable city fees. We've already reduced mobility fees, permit fees. We don't think that that they could be waived. You could amend the code to bring them down, to reduce them for workforce housing projects. But the committee at that time, based on the review of the fees and the fact that building permit fees are really to reimburse the building department for their reviews, determined that you wouldn't want categorically to reduce fees further. And that's what would be required here to accommodate this request. So
The question is, if we did not waive the fees, they would be costs that the development would pay. It wouldn't be paid by the developer, it'd be paid by the project. So the only thing that would reduce the cash flow on the backside, right? Because there would be less money left over to...
Correct.
Yeah, so
these would be paid by bond proceeds.
Exactly. So this is not a question of, it wouldn't affect the development fee. I don't think that we have to, this is not a high priority, I don't think today, because for me, it's a cash flow issue. It doesn't affect, The development arrangement, the developer shouldn't care, quite frankly, because it's going to be paid out of the bond proceeds. So it seems to me that as we move down the project, if there are additional fees that they are requesting, it should be brought to our attention to see if one of us want to carry an item that we could pass to give some special arrangement for this type of project. I think we're going to learn something new because this is a one of a kind, the first kind. It may end up being a good model that we want to replicate for other projects. I'm really excited about the way it's coming together and the structure of it. But I don't think today, because I don't think we know what all the fees could be. And I don't think that a decision by us today is going to change whether or not the developer takes the project or doesn't take the project, because it's not going to change their fee. Is that right?
That's right.
I believe that's correct.
I think it's just a cash flow issue on how much was left out of the bond proceeds. So I don't know. I don't think that we can make that decision today. That's just my view, Chair.
Yeah. All right. Commissioner Samuelin, you have your hand up. And then I'll go ahead.
Sure. I think that we should, you know, keep our fingers crossed that the ordinance passed in October. And I think it's an operating assumption from my view. That's the fees that are waived. I think making any other assumptions at this point would not be appropriate. So I'm hopeful that passes. I think that's the one that get waived. And the other covers the cost that we have from our building department.
So procedurally then, Eric, what do you need from us on this item? Do we just sort of know no position and we wait for the October commission vote? Or do you want us to say affirmatively no to this?
I think your feedback so far gives us direction as we're sitting at the negotiating table and finalizing some of these terms before it comes back to the full commission. I've got enough feedback, Rafael.
No, that's right. Yeah, we're good.
Okay. Then the next one, item number six, GU waivers.
Yes. GU waivers is the waiver of the parking requirement and the waiver of the minimum unit size. The minimum unit size is going from 400 square feet per unit to 387 for the 22 studio units. We felt that was a de minimis and it was a reasonable request. And the parking waivers we think make sense because we think we can find a solution with the garage next door.
Okay, Commissioner Samuelin and then Richardson.
I support both. Very small reduction and parking is right across the street, so I'm good on that item.
Okay.
And just to be clear, Eric, when you say the studio units, you're talking about the dormitory units on the second floor, right?
No, these would actually be the workforce housing units in floors 3 through 7.
Okay. 7 is going to be the top floor?
7's going to be the top floor.
Okay, great. How big are the dormitory style rooms on the second floor?
I believe it's one large room with bunk beds.
Got it. Okay. I'm fully supportive of both of these items. So perfect.
Okay. Yeah. So am I. So you guys okay? On this one?
Yep.
Okay. Then the last one, number 7, the waterfall list of eligible residents, and this is in the event that they can't find sufficient number of the first tier identified tenants, then they're asking us to give them the next order, right?
Yeah. And okay. The discussions were that, you know, you would move from tier 1 to tier 2 after a 30-day period. Would love to hear any feedback on whether 30 days is you know, a reasonable amount of time to move through the tiers. I think if you've got four tiers, you wouldn't want it to be too long, or you'll it'll be a year to try and rent an apartment because you.
Yeah. I mean, this is getting into the weeds, but we got to give some guidance here so that we achieve the objective in doing this project, which is try to create workforce housing, particularly for the artistic community. But there might not be enough in Miami Beach that are interested or can meet the eligibility requirements. So it's a fair ask, you know, what do they do in that event? Colleagues, how do you want to handle this? Commissioner Samuel and then Richardson.
Yep. I like the tiering approach. I was comfortable with tier one and two. My only question around this was I observed that City of Miami Beach employees who are not firefighters or emergency were not in any tier. And I'm just wondering if there was any rationale for that or if our other city employees should be prioritized.
The way I read it, and I could be reading it wrong, is that we're giving deference to law enforcement and firefighters in tier two, but then any other city employee, someone who is employed within the city of Miami Beach, would be eligible for tier three along with hospitality, cultural, or entertainment workers.
Fair enough, Eric. I'm tracking with you, and I think that's a reasonable I guess I'm sort of arguing a bit here as I think about it. Should there be a tier between two and three of our other city employees? I think there's community benefit in having employees reside on Miami Beach. I understand prioritizing our first responders, but I guess I'm thinking out loud. I look forward to hearing my colleagues of a tier between two and three of other Miami Beach City employees before we broaden it to the entire community.
Okay, Commissioner Richardson.
So help me out. In tier one was teachers and artists, is that right?
Yeah, artists and educators is tier one.
Okay, and then first responders are in tier two?
Nurses, law enforcement, firefighters, and any other emergency service providers employed in the city of Miami Beach.
So, but this is based on income, right? So it seemed, would they exceed the income cap, first responders? I don't know how big the cap is, but.
This would only be for someone that qualifies income-wise and meets the workforce housing requirements.
Right, but
the entire project.
Question, would any first responder meet the income?
Some might. The range is from $58,000 to, I believe, $120,000 for a family of four. And Maria Ruiz can confirm. I can get that info, but some employees might meet that.
Okay. And so just help, what kind of guidance do you need from us? Are we're okay with you doing the tiered approach? That we're okay with the 30-day? So I'm okay with the tiered approach and I'm okay with the 30-day. Yep.
Okay. Thank you.
30 days minimum. I was going to propose a little longer just because sometimes it just takes longer to get notice out. I mean, would you guys be more comfortable with 60 days? What happens if we push it out?
I'm okay with 60 days as well. So we could actually leave some discretion in there to say up to 60 days so that if there is a very large, I'd say up to 60 days. Okay. I'm okay with that.
All right. Well, Ray Breslin has his hand up and no one knows Collins Park like Ray. And then a representative of Servitas Group raised their hand. So Ray, why don't you go? Welcome.
Unmute. Okay. The only thing I have a question on is when you're looking at, you know, workforce housing, has it been determined out of this building how many are going to be studios, one bedrooms, two bedrooms, or three bedrooms? Because certainly that's going to make a difference as to who's going to be going into that building.
Yes. The preliminary proposal is the second floor is the dormitory, 30-bed dormitory for the Miami City Ballet. And then the 80 workforce housing units is broken out. It's 22 studios. I think it's about 37 is the number I think I remember of one bedrooms. And then there was the remainder.
33. It's 33 two bedrooms and 25 one bedrooms.
Okay. Thanks, Justin.
Okay.
So let me ask a question if I can, Chair.
Yeah.
So is there a reason that the categories, the tiers are so narrowly, like for example, in the first tiers, artists and teachers. So I get the artist piece because there may be the next door facility, the theater, there may be, you know, other artists and so forth. But is there a reason that, is there a greater demand or need for teachers to have workforce housing, or why are the nurses and why isn't all in one category is my question.
And I think the answer to that question is that when we were given instructions on putting out the RFP, I think it was supposed to be geared towards artists and educators. And so we wanted to respect that in tier one, and then the administration and Servitas kind of worked through tiers two, three, and four.
Okay.
And Commissioner, if I may, the larger the pool from the project perspective in terms of financing and making sure that you fill vacancies, the larger that tier one is, the better off the project is, the easier it is to fill the unit. So,
well, that's why I was maybe the first tier needs to include more than just artists and teachers, you know, maybe because that's pretty narrow. And how many units are going to be in the building?
80.
Excluding the dormitory, right?
Excluding the dormitory.
I don't know, colleagues, how you feel about that, but I would be in support of having more categories in tier one and having more employment diversity in the building. And also, yeah, I think that's fair. I don't know how I could justify having teachers and first responders in a lower tier when there's just as much need. So I would be in support of putting more categories in tier one.
It's a good catch, Commissioner Richardson. I'm also open to that. Ray has his hand up, and now Nick Richberg from Miami New Drama has his hand up. So after Ray, Nick, you go. Ray?
Okay. Originally, when this building was conceived, Miami City Ballet dorms were going to be on the top floor. And I just want to make sure that this has all been vetted out with them and they're perfectly happy with the second floor. And number two, we originally talked about artist live workspace, not necessarily just a residence, but that they would actually have a studio there that could possibly be open for the public to view them, similar to like what 800 Lincoln Road was years ago, but they didn't live there. They just had studios. And I'm just wondering, did we lose that in the translation or have we changed our mind?
So I think the short answer to the question is that's the intent. But ultimately we needed to come up with an agreement as to the pro forma for the building. So the city has asked for a right of first refusal on the first floor space with the intent to program it with cultural space. However, that's not been finalized, and ultimately the revenue from the first floor is needed to make the building function from a financial perspective.
Okay, thank you.
Nick? Nick, you're up, and then Miami City Ballet.
Sure. I just wanted to make the quick suggestion, because if the intent of the space was to serve arts and culture, you mentioned artists, but I don't know exactly how you're defining artists. And I heard something about people that work in culture later on in a lower tier. I would suggest that there are many people who work in the cultural space and for nonprofits who would definitely meet the income requirements of housing like this, that would be considered maybe not strictly artists, but certainly are part of making the arts possible in Miami Beach. And maybe they would be included in a higher tier if that's the intent of this property.
Thank you. A representative from the Miami City Ballet.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is Tanya Castroverde Moscalenko, Executive Director of Miami City Ballet. And I want to address Ray Breslin's question. And first of all, to thank him for his concern for Miami City Ballet. And to say that, yes, that we have had these conversations for weeks now, and Miami City Ballet is fine with being on the second floor of this building. And the other thing I just want to point out is that in addition to the students, Miami City Ballet does have 50 professional dancers and also a number of faculty and pianists who would also benefit from this workforce housing. Thank you.
Okay, I think that's everyone. Commissioner Samuelin, then Commissioner Richardson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to loop back on two points. First, I have no problem with what Commissioner Richardson suggested of maybe collapsing the tier, beefing up tier one a little bit, perhaps merging a tier one and two. And I did want to circle back, see if either of my colleagues have objection to calling out specifically Miami Beach City employees who are not explicitly called out and making them, you know, sort of part of the higher groups here.
Okay. Commissioner Richardson.
Thank you. So I wanted to ask Eric about the comment that we had on the cultural employees. Are they in a lower tier? Because I was thinking earlier too, when I was thinking about the community, like what if somebody is a museum curator or somebody works at the Bass, would they be eligible? So what tier are they in?
Tier one.
So that would be part of the artist category?
Yes, and when we did the competitive solicitation for this project, we provided a definition of artist that was including not only people involved directly in creating visual performance arts, any kind of artistic endeavor, but also employees of cultural organizations.
Okay, that's good, because I think that's important, because it's a cultural neighborhood, and if people are working in that area, they should have an opportunity. And to Commissioner Samuelin's comment, I am fine to elevate and move up the other city employees to give them the same standing in the same category. So that would be my recommendation as well, to move them into that category. Now, another question is, what do we do if you have 80 apartments and you have 100 applications in the first 60 days or 30 days, whatever it's going to be? What are you going to do? Are you going to draw straws, or are you going to have, what are you going to do?
So that is absolutely a question that I would like to kick to Servitas, because they would be managing the building, so that we don't end up in a situation where the city is getting sucked into those discussions.
Exactly. Did we have somebody from Servitas here?
Servitas. Yes.
Yes. Good afternoon. This is Angel Rivera, Senior Vice President of Development for Servitas. Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Commission members, for having us. We would have the tiered setup and the policies written ahead of time so that you'll be able to see them. It is important to the financing process that we establish it on the front end, and that it will be that it is in accordance with your resolution regarding this project. So if we were fortunate enough to have a long resident applicant list, longer than what the building can support, it will be filled in order of the tiers, right? So tier one or individuals or families who meet tier one will be first. Once that's filled up, we move down to tier two. And so, and then after that, we'd call the city and say, hey, if we did very well in this project, can we find another site and build more workforce housing for your citizens and residents?
Okay, thank you.
But how would you handle if you have 100 applications in the first 30 days and you have 80 apartments? What do you? I think we should give some guidance on this. I would hate to see somebody come to the let's go to the A's and the B's and the C's and forget the Z's, right? So let's what are you going to do?
Yeah, Commissioner Richardson, you're absolutely right about this. I recall I don't know it was 6-8 months ago when we opened our low income housing, thousands of applicants for a few dozen openings. So I think there's a very real situation that we're likely to face, especially with just 80 units in a brand new building. It'd be very desirable.
Right.
Yeah. Guys, we've been at this actually an hour and a half, so I want to move on. A very important project. Can we table this discussion? Can you just bring this back to us with some firmer recommendations, Eric?
Sure.
Okay. I think some kind of lottery system or something is a mechanism. We use it in... Yep.
I think that's what we should do, a lottery system. Exactly. Yeah.
And then open up the categories a little bit as well. I want to think through myself as to Miami Beach current resident getting priority versus somebody who works in Miami Beach, for example, for the ballet or the bass. How do we prioritize those folks too? I don't really have an answer today, but in the interest of time, let's move on, conclude this.
I think right now, Chair, it's if I understand, tier one is going to be artists, but the definition is broadly defined is what I heard. It could be somebody working in a cultural institution and it's education. That's tier one.
My question is yes, absolutely. That is what we're trying to capture. However, is it somebody who's currently now living, say, across the bay, but works at the Miami City Ballet, or somebody works at the ballet that is already a Miami City, Miami Beach resident? I think it's a real question because we've got a lot of people who are current Miami Beach residents that work in the artistic field that struggle to pay rent that would love to move here, versus we've got a lot of employees that work in our cultural institutions that live across the bay that would love to live closer to where they work.
Right.
I don't have an answer.
And how would you want to treat commissioners? Because I think our income would allow it.
Yes, that is true.
I will personally exclude myself. I won't take one of the 80 apartments, but it does sound delicious.
That is true. Commissioner Samuelin, you have the final word on this item.
I am going to exclude myself as well. I think, Mr. Chair, you raise a good point. I think the current recommendations are sort of silent on that issue of current residency. So maybe we can ask our city administration to come back explicitly recognizing that point of current resident versus employee. And I'll just close with how excited I am to see this project come to fruition and thank everyone who's been involved.
Excellent. Okay. Our next item.
So, Commissioner, would you want to move it out of committee so that we could take it to the October commission?
Absolutely.
To accept your recommendation?
Absolutely. Okay, colleagues, I had a request to hear item 13 next, discussion regarding the city subsidy of the Normandy Shores Neighborhood Improvement District, something we discussed the other day. Who's going to tee this one up?
I think John is on.
I'll handle it. Yep.
John Wooder? Okay.
Okay, so at the city commission meeting, we had a discussion regarding the 35% city subsidy to the Normandy Shores District. And so in the memo, we put together kind of the timeline of that's occurred over the years that got us to this point. And so what we'd like to do today is talk about that subsidy. And then second, While we were doing this research, we came across an issue related to the millage rate that we also need to cover. But I think we should start with the subsidy, because that was the portion of the discussion that came initially from the commission meeting. And so it's important that we land somewhere at the end of this meeting, because at the second public hearing on the 29th, we have to adopt a final budget, not just for Normandy Shores, but for the entire city budget. So it's very important that we resolve this one way or another. And so as part of the item that we have before you, we went through and talked to some of the city departments about the value to the city from the subsidy. And so property management and parks and even police all contributed to some of the information that we have here. And the one thing that is definitely clear is that the roving security guard that works after hours is definitely providing value, direct value to the city, because we've had reports, let's say in the past, before we had that rover, of people playing golf after hours, people gathering on the greens, having barbecues, drinking alcohol, vandalism, all kinds of things. And so we're pretty clear that is a value. What's a little less direct is the value of the security gatehouse itself, that everyone having to go through that, it has a value. It's just harder to quantify. And so I guess what I'd like to do is just based on that introduction, kind of hear questions or concerns from each of the committee members, and then we can queue up the appropriate department to maybe add a little more detail, if that's helpful.
Yep, that was good. We discussed this the other day. I mean, John, what are our options here? I mean, we could say no more subsidy. We could change the amount, right?
Yeah, in other words, we could definitely change the city subsidy. We could either, you know, we could eliminate it, we could reduce it. We have various options. I think from a staff standpoint, what we're a little concerned about is that this is at the, you know, this is kind of coming up at the very end of a process, and that for the district and the city, it would be fairly disruptive at this point to make a significant change to their budget. So our recommendation would be that if we are going to move in a different direction, that we would do that for the 22 budget and give everyone involved, you know, some reasonable amount of time to make that adjustment, to, you know, craft a budget that fits that funding amount, that kind of thing.
So, Chair, could I jump in here
for a moment?
So John, I think we have to tell everybody the full story before we give you input, because asking us to give you input on part of the story is not really fair. So colleagues, after this item was brought, and I grew concerned about the 35%, I asked the administration to pull the legislative history on this item. I then sent that to the legal department for review. And I also asked them to review the matter. And late yesterday, Rafael Paz called me with some rather startling news. And so I think before we make any decisions, he has something to share with all of us that will have a bearing on the decisions and the advice that we give the administration going forward. So we cannot bifurcate these issues. We need to put it all out on the table, and then let's talk about how we want to handle it. So, Chair, with your permission, I would like to turn that over to Rafael and let him tell us the rest of the story and what legal has learned.
Well, thank you, Commissioner Richardson, for doing that background and bringing it forward. So thank you.
Rafael?
Thank you, Commissioner. So just to backtrack, so the original legislation approving this district was adopted in 1993. It authorized a levy of up to 2 mills subject to a per property cap of $500 a year. Because of that cap, then by the year 2000, the city was contributing over 50% of the expenses of the district. The commission at the time wasn't happy with that split. And so in 2002, there was an amendment to the ordinance to eliminate the per property cap of $500 per property so that residents in the district could contribute more toward the district, and the city would maintain a contribution of 35%. I think the way this was framed up as a question for our office was, is this 35% allocation binding on the city commission? And the answer is, from our perspective, absolutely not. It is not legally binding. It is not in the text of the ordinance. It was part of the rationale for amending the ordinance, but there's nothing that we have seen either in the text or even in the background that there was a discussion that as the budget doubled, which because I believe the budget now is more than twice what it was in 2002, there was no discussion that the city would be somehow committing in perpetuity to maintain that allocation. Now, that said, That's not, unfortunately, in going through the legislative history, there's an additional piece of legislation that we found that we just have to address. In 2015, at the time, there were three other districts, and they were inactive. And at the request of then Commissioner Malakoff, she sponsored an ordinance to repeal the inactive districts. It was a cleanup ordinance. And at the time, then the staff working with Commissioner Malakoff identified the Normandy Shores District and realized this isn't codified in Muni Code. It hasn't been published. And it would be a good idea to readopt the legislation so that it could be codified. So that happened, and the Normandy Shores District was readopted in 2015 by ordinance, except that what was readopted was the 1993 version with the cap of $500 per property per parcel in the district. And so as a result of that, we learned this on Monday night, and I immediately spoke with finance, because what this means in terms of where we are is that this ordinance is in place. It's not what was intended by the 2002 amendment, but it is in place, and it does have a cap of $500 per property. And so finance would need to adjust the millage to reduce it so that no property pays more than $500. And that has a dramatic impact on the revenues of the district for this year. So John can get into the options for how to address and resolve this. And we would recommend that in October, that if we found a sponsor, that we bring an ordinance to amend the ordinance to correct this and to eliminate that cap that was readopted inadvertently in 2015. And as part of that, since you're considering now this allocation of the 35%, wherever you land on this issue, whether it's to continue it for a term of years or phase it out, we would recommend that in that ordinance that we just specify and the approach going forward, so that there's no dispute about of how we, you know, how we deal with the city's contributions toward the district in the future. So if you have any questions, this last piece is not in the memo that was released yesterday, since we just learned about it, you know, on Monday night.
Great job, Nick. And again, Commissioner Richardson, kudos to you for digging in. I see your hand is up. Did you want to say something?
Well, what this means is that the $93,000, because of this error that occurred, would not be our contribution if the taxing district wants to maintain the budget, which I think is $270,000, including the roving guard. So we would have to put up more. So I think really the questions that are going to be before us today in terms of a recommendation back to the commission, how will this be paid for? Do we recommend a budget cut, which I think is going to be difficult because I don't think the community wants to leave the guard gate open. And we heard from the administration that they see the biggest value in the roving guard. So that's worth, I've been told, about $50,000, but that's where the city sees the greatest benefit. We do know that we've learned that there is a reserve of about $100,000. Yeah, so all or part of those funds could be used to reduce the budget. But if we keep the same budget, we're going to have to figure out how much. And I don't know, John, I think you guys were crunching the numbers last night with the reduction in the millage rate because of this cap that inadvertently got put in place. How much more money would the city have to put up in excess of the $93,000 to fully fund the district at $270,000. Did you guys find a number or a rough order of magnitude?
Yes, we've been working very hard to come up with a solution to this issue, and I think we have a good solution. So what I'd like to do is share my screen real quick to just show some numbers that I think will help make this clear. Can you see my screen?
Yes.
Okay, great. So originally the millage rate was going to generate almost $173,000. The revised millage is going to generate dramatically less, $17,800. So what we're trying to, the problem to solve is $155,000 less revenue. So what we did is, I think as you mentioned, Commissioner, that the Normandy Shores has a small fund in it. It has some fund balance in it of $118,000. So that got us a big part of the way there. We spoke with the district and looked at their budget, and we felt that there was $20,000 that had been included in the budget that they could live without if needed. It was more of a want versus a need. And then we looked at their 2020 budget, the current year budget, and determined that they have close to $20,000 that may not get spent by the end of the fiscal year. We're only a few days away from the end of the fiscal year here, so we feel pretty good about it. So we feel that we can kind of plug that gap with the district, really the funds in the district, and not have to add to the current city subsidy. And so we feel like that's a fairly elegant solution, especially under the circumstances. And just want to get your reaction. If you're in agreement with this, we would then amend the memo and reso that's going to end up on the second public hearing on the 29th for Normandy Shores to be consistent with this plan.
Okay, yeah, Commissioner Richardson, your hand is
up. Let me just ask John, because I know that you guys were crunching the numbers, and I appreciate you guys staying last night to do that. So are you saying the fund balance, the reserve is 118? Because I'd heard it was about 100, but I didn't have a hard number. So is 118 the current reserve amount?
Yes, that's the right amount. And then if there's more savings in 20, which we're so close to the end of the fiscal year, we feel real confident that we're going to have at least 17,000, if not a little bit more. Between those two amounts, that's 135. And then we add the budget reduction of 20,000 that we feel is appropriate. And we have talked to the district about it. We had those discussions this morning. So we feel like this is a good plan.
So the 270, we would reduce that by 20 is your recommendation to come up with a budget of 250. And then the 155, that would leave about 95, which I think the city contribution was around 93. So that's how we would bounce. So your plan would continue to have the city fund next year at the 93,000 or whatever that was originally proposed, right?
Correct. The city subsidy of $93,100 would remain the same under this plan.
Yeah. So I will, let me go ahead and weigh in, Chair, on I'm happy to see that the reserves were a little bit higher than I thought they were when I talked last night. That's good. You know, I think it would be difficult for us to change this at the last hour. If we had found out about this 35% 6 months ago, then I think that we could have gone to the community and warned them that maybe that number is too high, that percentage is too high. But I think it's the last hour. I do think that going forward next year, if no one else brings an item, I'll bring an item so that we can provide clarity to the community in terms of the contribution that the city wants to make. And, you know, we cannot ignore that there is a dispute going on in the community and the community adjacent to this district about the clickers. And, you know, this was brought to our attention because somebody did a review and discovered that the city, the taxpayers, were making this contribution. And this is part of that. And I think that this is going to be part of that continuing conversation, because I think the taxpayers on the outside of the gate have a legitimate issue in that the taxpayers of the entire city are paying or contributing to this. And I know the golf course is there, but what I learned last week when I first discovered the issue is that there is no other special taxing district in the city that provides this sort of subsidy. There's a park in over on Palm. They don't get any allocation at all. So I do think that going forward that we should step down the amount that the city is contributing, but I will support this plan this year for this budget, because we have to get a budget out.
Okay.
And thanks for all the hard work, Rafael, you did, and John, crunching these numbers and reviewing the legal history and finding this error.
Okay. Commissioner Samuelin, you're up, and then we have a few members from the public that wish to speak.
Thank you, Commissioner. Mr. Chair. John, would you please just screen share again with the big numbers? Because my sense is we came in to have one discussion, but the actual decision on the table is quite a bit different. So I just want to confirm my take here. Line four, the revised millage 17-18-16, that number is locked because of the ordinance error. We can't change that. Is that correct?
Yeah, what's going to happen is the memo for the second public hearing will have the current millage, because that's what was adopted at the last second at the first budget hearing, but we will recommend changing it to what would the millage rate that would generate this amount of 17,800. So what that's really doing is what that means, and why it's informing the discussion on the 93,000 city subsidy, is that if now we choose to reduce the city subsidy, this plan won't work. In other words, this won't be enough to be able to maintain the budget for the district. So what happened is this really took all the flexibility out of the district's budget, if you will, in order to patch this for 1 year. So that's why we would recommend that if the commission wants to potentially adjust or eliminate that city subsidy, that we would do it for next year's budget.
Right. So that was my takeaway as well. It seems like given line four is locked, that to have any chance at making the bridge, you actually assumed that funding wasn't really changing. You said that we had to do that, and then you've come up with this bridge. So the decision in front of us is, do we buy into 7, 8, 9, and 10 to make a bridge? My perspective, I believe consistent with what my colleague just said, is I do. I think we need a bridge. This looks like a reasonable bridge. So I think that's actually what we really need to decide today. I'm supportive of that. I do believe we need to have a broader conversation moving forward. I appreciate what Commissioner Richardson brought forward and the notion that, you know, the dispute with the clickers is sort of an overlay and an intersection. And I look forward to that conversation.
Sorry, I'm on mute. We've got a few people that want to speak. Glenda Phipps up first. You have 2 minutes.
Hi, thank you. And thank you, Commissioner Samuelin, for letting us know that this conversation has really changed. So I hope all of you can appreciate the fact that not only did the city commission do a great job and city staff in investigating this, but just the fact that we questioned it has brought something to light that we all should be concerned with. As Commissioner Samuelin said, this initially came out because we have been trying to understand why our neighbors on Normandy Shores were not open to us having access to our streets through the convenience gates in the back, not the main guard gate. And that has just revealed a whole lot of things. I'm a little taken aback because of all the new information, but I really was appreciative of the memo, but I want to make a really clear distinction in the memo. The memo keeps talking about how the legality is not codified, the 35%, but it also doesn't make clear the fact that we're talking about two different things. 35%, which was contributed, which is $93,000. And then there's an additional cost for the rover. When you read the memo from the city, it sounds like we're talking about the same thing and we're not. We have no problem with the golf course having a rover. And, you know, it's up to the commission to decide if that cost should be shared. What we have a problem with is the 35% subsidy, which Commissioner Richardson has said no other taxing district has. On top of that, I'm really shocked to learn today that even with that subsidy, the HOA, the Normandy Shores, actually had a reserve of money. So not only are they getting a subsidy, they had a reserve. Again, it sounds like this is a conversation that is going to have to continue later, but not having access is a real...
There's a Zoom user. I'm sorry, I don't have your name. I just see Zoom user. You have 2 minutes.
Hello, that's me. Oh, this is Paul Mocha from 95 South Shore Drive. Yes, I think what Glenda was just talking about, obviously there's a difference between a 35% subsidy and the rover. Obviously, in light of the new information that's come out, there's a lot more to discuss about this. But I do think that we have a serious issue with taxpayer dollars funding a taxing district. And then that same taxing district is blocking public streets from the public access in a very unique situation as well. As far as the budget process, I'm confused as to why it's too late now. If we had first reading at the commission meeting and this was brought up, it went to committee and now it's coming back for second reading, how in the budget process is there not time to make adjustments? I find that very difficult. If we knew about it 6 months ago, how would we have known about it 6 months ago? The HOA had their special meeting to put the budget together in April during the stay-at-home orders. We were told it was put out as a public notice. I don't know where it was public. I get all the emails. I didn't see it. But it was also during a pandemic. So as we're trying to follow along the process, when do we inject ourselves? I did like the conversation that if because there's just nothing you can do this year, that you're going to take a serious look at it next year. But I really don't want my tax dollars subsidizing private security for a neighborhood when they can raise the funds themselves to pay for it. Thank you.
Okay, John Bose. You have 2 minutes.
On mute. Okay, hi, commissioners, and thank you for the time and the opportunity. Let me take my mask off, hold on. Okay, so, I've been very integral in this whole thing for many years now. I've lived here 30 years. I know firsthand what the indirect benefits of the guard and security system has been over the 30 years. It's not a direct benefit, but it certainly has value to the city in its indirect way. It just makes people and criminals think twice about coming into our neighborhood. All the crime reports show the absolute benefits for, you know, for this tax district and what it's done compared to the rest of Normandy Isles. That's first and foremost. Secondly, the reserves are put in place each and every year. If we don't, if the budget isn't totally utilized, and I know John can probably speak better to this, the portion that's not utilized gets pushed over to the following year. So it's really not money, you know, that that the city is just going to pull and throw in. It's money from our taxpayers that have been put into that account for needs like hurricane comes, blows the guardhouse away, or, you know, something major cost breaks. So, you know, that I think, you know, is a point that I really wanted to bring up. You know, as far as the rover and the cost, and, you know, it's a valid cost and certainly something that the commission should always think about, what's valid about how much they should contribute or not. But I would say something, you know, the city pays for a lot of things that don't have direct benefit to every single citizen. You know, we've got school systems, we've got, you know, security systems for City Hall and lots of things that the city pays for that may or may not have a direct benefit to each and every citizen. So, you know, I would say that, you know, you also have to think about, you know, what's good for the city overall and maybe not the individual, and consider the benefits to what's in place and the reasoning for it. There's nothing being hidden here. This 35% has been in play for many, many, many years.
2 minutes.
Thank you.
Carolyn Berg, and then Daniel Beecher.
Great. Thank you very much, Carolyn Berg. I'm a resident of the Normandy Shores Taxing District, been a resident here since 2001. I think I have to reiterate a couple points. Number one, this is no secret. It has been in the ordinance. It is in the 1993 ordinance. I can't say that this is an error. It's explicitly stated in there. It's no surprise to anybody. Second of all, the fact that we have surplus is partially funded by our tax dollars. I myself pay $574 for that gate every year. Whether we go forward, whether we do an amendment in the future, that's fine. But I will get billed in my tax year 2020, $574 for that. So I think this has to be part of a larger conversation, as Mr. Richardson pointed out, and we can't be taxing somebody for a service they don't receive. The other thing, and I think I have to reiterate John's points, is there's tons of services the city funds. Elderly services, food services, women battered shelter. That's great. And I'm very pro all those services that I do not directly benefit from. So we really have to think about this at a more macro level and not at the last minute. And at the same time, reiterate that most of these houses, some of the newer houses, pay up to $8,000 for that gate. So the average is $494 per household. So yes, you know, there is a larger picture here, and there is a security issue here, especially when the golf course takes up 55% of the land in this taxing district. I'll leave it at that.
Okay, thank you. Daniel, you're up, and then Kim Brown Eve is last, and then John Bowes, you put your hand back up, but we're trying not to have people come back. So, okay, thanks. Daniel?
Yes, thank you, commissioners, and thank you for taking a look at this issue. I don't look at it as a taxing district. I look at it as one island. This is a very different island, both in the single-family home and the multi-housing section over a decade ago. If you go through there today, it's changed quite a bit. There is one golf course affecting the entire island, and as you can see, the rover service only services really the single-family area of the golf course, and we're not sure if a lot of these services funding the golf course services also impact the multifamily. For me, it's not really the tax district budget. I do think you guys need to take a look at that and work with the taxing district. It's a great mechanism. It's really about equal access and having, you know, recognition of the multifamily area, being part of that community and part of that island in every conversation and every aspect of city services provided on Normandy Shores. Thank you so much. I appreciate you looking at this issue.
Thanks. Last caller is going to be Kim Brown Eve. Kim?
Yeah, can you hear me? I'm okay. Yeah. Hi, I'm Kim Brown Eve. I live on Normandy Shores also. I think we're quite taken aback having complained about the $93,000 subsidy, and now the city is going to increase that, which is really a surprising turn of events when at the end of the day, this is a private security system that benefits only a very select few. I have to disagree with what Carolyn and John were saying about, you know, paying for schools and women's shelters, that those benefit all of us. This private security system benefits only the people that live in that neighborhood. And also the idea that we can't change the budget. I mean, we're all changing our budgets now of all years to be spending not only the $93,000, which increases from year to year. We did not know it was going to be $93,000 this year. In light of the economic hardships that we're all facing, it seems like an astronomical amount when that's outside of what the golf course pays for its rover. You know, if I found out that I no longer had the funds to pay for a vacation I was planning, I wouldn't take the vacation. I feel that the HOA should have a choice to make. Either they come up with the funds on their own, like Biscayne Point does, like the Sunsets do, they all contribute equally to their gates, or they don't have that service for the year because they just don't have the money for it. So the fact that now they're going to be paying even less, trying to block us from using those gates, and the city's going to be paying more, it's just upside down world to me.
Thank you, Kim. Okay. Okay, Kim, you're done. Okay. All right, let's bring it back up to the dais. Colleagues, any comments or words here? Commissioner Samuel, you just put your hand up, and then Richardson.
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I appreciate the comments from residents who have varying perspectives. And I feel a little bit bad. Many were prepared to have one conversation, but the real issue is we're having a different conversation. And that's just the reality, and we're all learning about this. But I think the most important point that I took away, which was confirmed on the record, is the amount provided by the HOA, the millage, we're legally locked for this year. That number is not moving, that's 17,000. That is just a fact that we can't alter. And I think what we're trying to do is build a bridge so we have a budget for what happens in the future. That's that other discussion, which, again, I appreciate my colleague, Commissioner Richardson, stepping forward on that. And we have to talk about all that. That's for another day. But I think the decision in front of us is, given that 17,000 is locked, how do we build the bridge? So I support the administration's recommendation, and I will move that as the recommendation.
Commissioner Richardson, and then John Woodruff, you have your hand up. Commissioner Richardson, would you like to go first?
So I will say that some questions were raised by some participants about changing the budget, but when this came to light and I learned about it late yesterday, I asked that question, is there anything that we could do to fix this error in the next, it's the 23rd, so we have 7 days before the end of the fiscal year. And I was told that the error could not be fixed. And so there wasn't the option of fixing this and charging the taxing district homeowners the millage that was budgeted. We have to reduce it, and that's what the 17,000 is. So the other thing is that because of the reserve, the city will not have to put up more than the 93,000, which was budgeted. And I totally understand that there are some people that think that that's $93,000 too much, but we're learning at this at the last hour. I accept the recommendation of the administration. I will be happy to bring an item. I already have some ideas on how I can solve this going forward. And so I will bring an item for the next fiscal year. I think legitimate concerns have been raised about taxpayer dollars being used. And I think that we cannot ignore that there is a clicker issue that is linked to this. But we have to pass a budget in the next 7 days. We cannot fix the error in that time. So I accept the recommendation. I will join you and second the item, Commissioner Samuelin.
Okay. John, you have your hand up. Did you want to add something?
Yeah, I just want to be crystal clear for everyone who's watching that the fix that we're proposing, this additional funding to help make up the difference from the millage change, is coming from the district's own fund balance, which again, 65% of that has been paid for by the property owners, and 35% of that has come from the city. But that's money that's basically just sitting in a bank account. We're not adding to the $93,000 subsidy that exists today. So I just wanted that to be crystal clear. Thank you.
Okay, there's been a motion, a second, and I support it. So let's move this item. Okay, all right. We'll go back to the top of the agenda. I'm going to try to fly through some of these. Colleagues, do you have anything you want me to take out of order, or staff? Okay. Actually, I see Marcia DePratt just put her hand up, and I believe you're here for, you're with the Transit Alliance. What number would that one be? Is that why you have your hand up?
Yes, I think that's the first item, like item 8.
Would you want us to hear that?
Yeah, that'd be great.
Okay, you've been long enough.
All right, so.
We don't have to be here regardless, so just trying to be courteous to folks who've been waiting patiently. So that's item number 8?
Yes, hi, sorry.
Okay, great. All right, so just wait until we open it to the public. Who wants to tee up item 8, which is to discuss the bike pedestrian master plan? Give us an update on where we're at with that.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair.
Joselle? That's Jose. Okay.
How are you, Mr. Chair?
Good. How are you?
Good. Thank you for the opportunity to update the committee as well as our community on the status of our bicycle pedestrian master plan projects. There is an LTC that's attached as part of your item, but since this item has been deferred a couple times, the LTC is already a couple months old, so I wanted to provide a fresh update to you all today. Our master plan was adopted by the City Commission in April 2016. So in essence, that was our start date, and it included a robust portfolio of bike lane projects and shared use paths. For the past 4 years, my team has been working diligently to advance a slew of bike lane projects throughout the city. It's important to understand that given our constrained streets, most bike lane projects require either a road diet or some type of reconfiguration or repurposing of the existing right-of-way in order to accommodate protected bike lanes that meet standards. So for this reason, traffic studies, feasibility studies are required in the early stages of every project. And as a matter of process, bike lanes are considered traffic control and thus fall under Miami-Dade County's jurisdiction. So we need to work closely with the county as well as with FDOT if the bike lane project is on a state road. So then we go to the next phase and develop engineering drawings that require county review and permit approval prior to construction. And so I'd like to provide an overview of all our active and completed projects. And I know Josiel is on the line, so if he can queue up, we have just about 3 or 4 maps that we want to share with all of you of all our bike lane projects in the various phases of development. And as we move through the maps, you'll see the progress and how the network is coming together. I'll note that for purposes of this map, we're not including the 11 miles of green bike lane, which we've completed since the adoption of the master plan in 2016. So we start with project development. As I mentioned, that's where every project starts. It's the planning and the design phases. We've got almost 7.5 miles that are currently of projects that are currently in this phase. The LTC references 9.48 miles, but some projects have already transitioned to construction, so they're not reflected in this phase. The next map shows projects that are in construction. And we've got over 3 miles. It's right, 3.3 miles of projects that are actively in construction. The number in the LTC was about 1 mile. But we've had additional projects come online ever since that date, including the Meridian Avenue bike lanes from Dade Boulevard on the north to 16th Street on the south. Indian Creek Drive bike lanes. That's part of the Indian Creek Drive project. And the beach walk that's under construction in Mid Beach, where the boardwalk used to be. And then moving on to projects that have been completed since adoption of our plan in 2016, we've got roughly 2.4 miles. The number in the LTC was 1.35 miles. However, we've completed some projects since.
Hey, Jose, I'm sorry yes. for the interruption, but I don't know how long this presentation is going to last.
This is the last slide.
Okay, thank you.
That's it, yeah. So just to mention some of the projects that we've completed, Meridian Avenue from 41st Street to 47th Street, the Washington Avenue Road Diet Pilot, and the Meridian Avenue Green Sharrows.
Okay. Is that it?
That's it for this piece. And then I just wanted to highlight some of the firsts that I take great pride in as being on the forefront, certainly within Miami-Dade County. The Washington Avenue pilot that I just mentioned is the first road diet with parking protected bike lanes implemented in the county. The Meridian Avenue bike lane that I mentioned from 16th Street to Dade Boulevard is the first road diet that's been implemented. And the section just to the south from 17th to 16th is eminent. And we're also on the cusp of implementing a green bike box at West Avenue and 17th Street, which will also be the first in the county.
Okay. Thank you.
You're welcome.
All right. Colleagues, anything you want to hear from the public? I'll just tell you the reason I put this, on the agenda for us today is one is to get an update on the status of our efforts to improve our bike lanes. We committed to this years ago, spent a lot of time and money master planning this, and then have made some inroads into creating bike lanes, a little bit protected bike lanes. My concern, having seen now several years of expected improvements in our bike lanes, and there's been delays, and a lot of times it's for very good reasons. We're waiting for certain road work to be done, some of our resiliency projects to move forward, and so why are you going to go and spend a lot of money on bike lanes when we're going to tear up the road in a year or two? Problem is that with things like the pause and other delays, we're also delaying our fulfillment of our commitment to the community to install bike lanes as well as decrease traffic through the increase of other transit options. And so I wanted us to discuss that today because it's sort of my feeling is that for a lot of reasons, we are somewhat delayed in where we should be given what, the master plan, had called, the vision had called for. That's why I brought this today. We've got some folks from the public. There's a call-in user 5. You're listed as call-in user 5. And then Marcia Duprat.
Hi, Commissioner Arriola. This is Matthew Goltanoff. I do have some comments on this. At first, I wasn't sure if I wanted to participate because I think, this plan is relatively new and it might be a little unfair to criticize the efforts the city has made, because as pointed out earlier on, they've made a lot of progress in the last couple of years. And about 2 years ago, I became involved in bicycle and pedestrian advocacy at Miami Beach. And when you get involved in that, you kind of see the roadblocks that slow down these projects. And Jose and his team have done a tremendous job. They're professional. I think they're a great partner to work with. From the beginning, when projects are under conceptual, and then they go into design, they take feedback, and some of the items that we have suggested, they've implemented, actually. So I think they've done a great job, and as you could see here, the dominoes are falling. Projects that have been under consideration for years are being implemented. A lot of times, unfortunately, it's traffic studies and permitting and rounds of comments back and forth with partner agencies that the city has to work with. And throughout this, I think the city's been pretty responsive with some of the bicycle advocates in giving us updates. But what I will say is I think one of the biggest problems that we face here is actually our elected officials. We've seen it recently. We've seen it this morning. You know, the city, the professionals in the city who use their expertise present plans to committees, to the full commission, and then they get shot down. You know, there's concerns about traffic. There's this pervasive windshield perspective. Everything is seen through the eyes of the automobile. Right. They don't see the flip side of this, which are residents who are asking for this, residents who actually use this. Miami Beach is probably one of the best cities in the state, no doubt, but even in the country for riding a bike, for recreation, for actual, you know, trips to commercial activities, cultural, educational. In fact, I just got back a few minutes ago from picking up my daughter from school on a bicycle. And I'm happy to know we took the Washington Avenue protected bike lanes, and it was great. It was safe. It was convenient. It was low stress. These are the kind of things that we want to see implemented. But I think that the support from you guys, and I know that there are certain members who have been very supportive, but there's also members who have, you know, put obstacles up and have slowed this down and or taking projects down the wrong path.
I think the 2 minutes are up there. Thank you for your comments. Next up is Marcia DePry.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yeah.
All right, so I'm Marcia Lupet. I'm representing Transit Alliance today, but I'm also a Miami Beach resident. And, you know, by now I think we all know why we need protected bike lane networks. You know, they make sense from a safety, health, environmental, economic standpoint. And as a community, we've understood this. And as a city, you guys understood this when you adopted this plan 5 years ago, but we haven't really been very action-oriented in how to achieve these goals. So we audited what was supposed to be built by 2020 in terms of protected bike lanes and green bike lanes, so not sharrows or shared paths or all of these things that are easier to implement. And we found that close to nothing has been built. So just to be clear, In our audit, we don't have like bike lanes that are in planning or in design or in permitting or in construction or anything that like I right now can't go out into the street and bike on. So our only ask, I think, at this point is that, you know, we have proven as a city that we can be tactical, we can be adaptive. We have proven this with Ocean Drive and with Washington Avenue and hopefully with Collins moving forward. And we've set a really high bar for ourselves as a city with very specific goals for better mobility and a more resiliency here. So really what we need is to execute the plans that we have adopted. So we've spent a lot of money and it's like, it's time to really think of how can we execute the plans that we have adopted now so that we can meet our goals 10 years from now, 20 years from now, 3 years from now. So thank you.
Thank you. Gail Durham and then Sean Patrick Bryan.
Oh, hi there. Thank you, Ricky. My name is Gail. I live on West Ave. I bought a bicycle in April during the isolation, and now I am an enthusiastic bike rider for the first time. So I have a favor to ask. The West Ave bike lane from 8th Street to 14th Street has already been approved, but there's massive delays because this project is so big. We haven't even broken ground yet, and it's going to take 3 years to build. So I was wondering, is it possible to just paint the bike lane now from 8th Street to 14th Street since there aren't any parking spots on that side of the street? You know, I don't think it would take too much of an effort. I was just wondering. Thank you.
So, Gail, thank you for bringing that up. That's precisely one of the reasons I wanted to put this on the agenda. And you correctly cited one of the projects that had been delayed for a lot of reasons. And one of the, you know, unintended consequences, the collateral damage of that delay is what I think is going to be one of the nicest bike lanes in the city, but we haven't been able to finish it or start it because we know that this project at some point is going to hopefully happen. So this is what happens when we delay projects. We also delay, you know, other things that we're committed to doing, including more bike lanes in our city. And we'll ask staff about your question after we hear from a few more folks, Sean Patrick Bryant, and then Ray Breslin. Sean, you're on. Sean, you have 2 minutes. I think you're on mute.
Okay, just quickly following up on the last statement that you made, Ricky, the Gail was referring to the section between 6th and 8th Street, which already has been completed. So it's not a part of the other part of West Avenue that you mentioned. Just wanted to make a couple brief comments. I agree with much of what Matthew said earlier. And I just want to say to Josiel and Jose, as far as the bike box at 17th and West, you know, that is very important. It's been almost 2 years that I've been working with you on this. So it's good to hear that it's moving forward. But, you know, we just have to accelerate some of this. We just get in this holding pattern of nothing gets completed. So I'm going to reach out to you after the meeting to talk to you about the bike box specifically. But Commissioner, thanks for having this topic on your agenda.
Sean, I don't know if that was just me, but you faded out. We can't hear you.
Okay. I'm actually done. Yeah, I was just saying that the bike box has been working in the plan for almost 2 years. So we're looking forward to accelerating that. And I'll talk to Josiel and Jose offline about that. But Commissioner, thanks for putting this agenda on the item, this item on the agenda.
Okay. Ray, you have the last word, and we'll bring it to the dais.
Okay. It's just very simple. When you do something temporary and you're painting green, and I think Jose would agree with me, it's over $6 a square foot to paint that green paint. $6 a square foot. Think how much money you're going to spend to put something temporary that you're going to take it back out. You have to figure out some other way to do it. Thank you.
Okay. Thanks, Ray. Let's bring it back up. Colleagues, any comments? Commissioner Samuelin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I appreciate you putting this forward. This is really important. I think our transportation master plan was pretty clear that we prioritize pedestrians and cyclists. So I'm glad we're having this conversation. I think that we do need to move faster. And I believe it was Marcia who said more action oriented. I absolutely like that theme. My own assessment of where we are, I would say I feel better today than I would have several months ago. Several months ago, it might have been harder to put my finger on as many improvements, but I do look at what we did on Washington Avenue, what we've done around Ocean Drive, and those are pretty tangible. So the scorecard is improving, at least in my view. In terms of priorities moving forward, first, I would like to hear the city administration comment on tactical opportunities as it relates to West Avenue. That would be number one. Number two, we have some really important priorities for protected bike lanes on Indian Creek as part of that project and the Venetian Way, where we're talking to the county. I very much would like to see those come to fruition sooner rather than later. And finally, we as a policy group will have a chance to weigh in as soon as the October Commission, I believe. We have a very unique sort of tactical opportunity in Flamingo Park, which we discussed at Neighborhoods today, for slow streets, signage that makes the area more bike friendly. I'd like to see that happen sooner rather than later as well. That's all my comments.
Okay. Yeah, I want to try to conclude this soon. So Commissioner Richardson, you'll have the last word.
Okay, I'll be brief. Just ask Jose on the green lanes. I really like the green lanes. What is do we have anything written in city policy to have green lanes? Because I know when I was at the state, they had no uniform policy. I know over on Key Biscayne, the lanes are painted green as well. Do we have any local ordinance to require they be painted green?
Not an ordinance. If I remember correctly, the issue of painting existing bike lanes in green did go to the City Commission years ago, probably around the 2015-2016 timeframe. And it was the City Commission's desire at that time to paint all existing bike lanes in green to try to enhance their safety.
Yeah.
It was not an ordinance, I know that for sure. It may have been a resolution. We'd have to dig it up, but that's where that the green came from.
I won't take the time here then. I'll call you separately on that because I think they do make it. As a bicyclist myself, they make it a lot safer. And so I think you guys have been doing a terrific job. I think we're moving in the right direction. You know, we're always weighing the balance between pedestrians and bicyclists and the vehicular traffic. I was kind of surprised by the young lady's comment, and I wrote it down. She says that her audit shows that nothing has been done. And I wouldn't say I wouldn't agree with that. I think you guys have done a lot, and I appreciate all your efforts. So thank you very much. I'm going to call you separately on the green, the bike lanes, so I can look at specifically what's requiring that, because I love those. They make it safer. Thank you. Okay. Thank you.
Yeah. And I agree with you, Commissioner Richardson, that the green bike lanes do create awareness and therefore safety. Protected bike lanes would be the gold standard. Sometimes they're not feasible and they're more expensive, but certainly the green helps. I wanted to put this on here just to get an update. Given the opportunity, you know, Jose and Joselle and the team would get this all done for us right away, but there are other things that prevent them from doing that, whether they're, you know, awaiting permissions from the county or the state, or even our own actions or inactions that delay them. But I wanted to at least have this discussion today. I, for one, you know, want to encourage the staff to, be creative. If there are opportunities to fill in little gaps, if there are opportunities to do something even temporary that makes financial sense, to go ahead and do that. And then also, lastly, push back on us. You can definitely push back on me. You know, let us know when you see something that we're doing that's going to delay us from fully implementing this plan, just so that we're aware of it, so that we consider that as we make, you know, policy decisions. Okay.
Chair, I'll just add one more question.
Yeah.
I would say that, you know, on West Avenue, the original plan was for West Avenue to be done immediately after Alton Road. You know, that project started, I was a state rep, I think 13 was finished in early 16, and the plan was, but there were delays because of the resiliency efforts and so forth. And that's why we don't see dedicated bike lanes on Alton, is because the city made a deal with FDOT to put those bike lanes, those dedicated lanes on West Avenue. The other thing I'll mention quickly is that as a bicyclist myself, I know that if I ride in Key Biscayne, I have to observe the traffic signs and so forth, or they will pull you over and give you a ticket. And as more people are using bikes here and sharing our roads, I don't know what we can do to encourage people to obey the laws, but I routinely see bicyclists go through stop signs and so forth. And I know in Key Biscayne, I stop at every red light and every stop sign, because if you go through them, you're going to get ticketed there. So that's something that we need to be mindful for going forward as well. Thank you so much.
Yeah, thanks. Okay, we'll move on. Item number one, discussion regarding Miami Beach Community Development Corp and its financial condition. Commissioner Richardson, you're listed as sponsored. I think you might have picked this up from Commissioner Malakoff. Is that correct?
Yeah, and in the interest of time, Chair, let's defer this item and move it to next month, if that's okay with my colleagues.
Absolutely. I am taking offers to defer items. Colleagues, do you have other items you want to defer? No. Okay. I'm going to defer item number four in the interest of time, even though it's very much like the bike master plan, to try to create awareness and just have a discussion on, where things stand. But I'll defer that because I know Mr. item number Chair. Three is going to take some time. Commissioner Samuelin, yes.
Yeah, I just wanted to weigh in because I understand we're under the gun and we had some very good discussion. To transportation, Jose, item number two, I'm very excited to talk about the BRT, but is there anything time sensitive on that? Because we are a little under the gun. Do you need a decision for us, or is that something we could push back 30 days?
Commissioner, this was more of an update.
Okay.
It's a standing item. It's more of an update. The county is participating on the Zoom call. They're ready to make a quick update if that's the will of the body, but I know that you're running a little short on time today.
Yeah. I think if it's only an update, which was my understanding, I would be okay to defer that unless you have an objection.
Are you I'm asking with us? That.
Yeah, no, I was talking to Jose, so we'll defer number two as well, Mr. Chair.
Okay, great. Colleagues, just to manage time, I think item number five, I think that's a moot point. It's Commissioner Gongora's item, and I guess Commissioner Minor as well. Is that moot already or no?
Well, if it's not moot, sir, we could, it's not on the critical path of anything. So we could defer that until next month, I
Let's
think.
Let's defer that because they talk about a free concert for the Super Bowl. Maybe it's the title is wrong because obviously the Super Bowl happened. Let's defer that one. I know items number three and item number 10 are going to take a little bit of time. Item three probably taking the most time. And I see my boss, Nancy Liebman, is already chomping at the bit waiting to talk. So who wants to tell us where we're at on item number three, the Byron Carlisle RFP negotiations?
Chair, I can take that item. I can tell you that we are still discussing the item with the sole remaining proposer. We have engaged CBRE in the process and we are waiting. I think we received the pro forma with the financial information within the last few days. So CBRE is still reviewing. Our goal was to have a conversation similar to the one that we had today for the Collins Park Workforce Housing in the October Finance Committee.
Colleagues? Okay, let's go to the public on this one. Nancy Liebman? Nancy, I think you're on mute. Nancy, you're on mute.
Here. Okay. You hear me now?
Yes, we do.
Okay. I know that you're still debating about the lone bidder, but we have a group that has organized. It's a new group of people who are mainly professionals in the world of artistic presentations. They are many of them who live on Miami Beach. But since this is traveling so slowly with the one bidder, we would like to introduce ourselves and tell you what we are, why we are here, and what we're interested in. The Byron Carlisle Theater has become a neglected asset, as we all know. Though it has not been historically designated, it doesn't have to be, because it is a true iconic treasure in the city. And if you talk to the people who live in this community, especially a lot of us who have been here for many years, we all loved the Byron. So we'd like you to consider the fact, after you finish with that, with the one bidder, whatever you do with that, I don't know. But we would like you to know that the Byron at one time was the centerpiece of North Beach. This is way back. And it still could be if it had been given some attention. It's been neglected over the years. The city never tried to do anything to it or for it. So we, the residents, are supporting the Byron to be maintained and have the opportunity to be reactivated and reactivate the pleasures and memories of North Beach as well as the rest of the community. If you look back at the things that have happened that have brought attention and resilience to a community. It has been the arts and the diverse population, especially up here in North Beach. They have many things, wonderful waterways.
Nancy, okay, thank you, boss. Next is Manning Salazar, followed by Daniel Vaisha.
Yes, hi, can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay, hi, my name is Manning Salazar, and I'm with the neighborhood organization to save North Beach. It's also called No Snob. And I'd like to speak to this issue that we're discussing today about basically tearing down our beloved Byron Carlyle, which has been a landmark in our community for decades, and replacing it with another high rise on the main street of our town center. I don't think the committee should be surprised that the community is overwhelmingly opposed to this and is in favor of saving the theater. There's a petition that's been circulated that has close to 1,000 signatures, and every day more people sign up. As Nancy mentioned, there's a group of professionals and community leaders who have come together to make a proposal, a serious proposal about how they can save the theater, fix it, and create a cultural center that we think will benefit the community and beyond. We strongly feel that by fixing a theater, we're not only going to provide the community with a place to go and to access culture and quality programming, but that it'll also act as an anchor to our town center and spur business and economic growth and create jobs. We've seen how saving theaters like this have helped revitalize many town centers as close as in Hollywood with the Cinema Paradiso. South Beach has the New World Theater, it has the Colony, it has the Fillmore, it has the Yo Cinema, the Wilsonian, the Bass, the Miami City Ballet, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. North Beach, the forgotten stepchild, has nothing. And so, you know, we think that there's money for this project. The city manager has said that repairing the Byron Carlyle will cost as little as $3 million. We have $60 million to spend on a parking garage a block from the beach that no one wants or needs. There's a CRA that's proposed for North Beach that has been met with suspicion and opposition by the community. And designating the repair of the Byron Carlyle for the CRA would go a long way in generating some feelings of support. So I think there's money for this. It's just a question of priorities.
Daniel, you're up.
Thank you, Commissioner, and thank you for taking the side and requesting a progress report. Sadly to say, this is going to be maybe the 10th time in two decades that we're talking about what we're going to do with the Byron Carlyle. It is surely the fourth time we issue an RFP, and I think the city's standings on the ability to renovate the building are what they are. I think it's clear that the city is dedicated to providing a cultural facility. That's why the RFP requires there to be a cultural center within the development. I think that the city should either move forward with the RFP or reissue the RFP. The fact that this process has been stalled for a year and a half is certainly concerning to me. I wouldn't see that type of stall in any other area of the city. We are clear on what we're trying to do here, and I would certainly appreciate the city commission and administration working diligently to move forward with the Byron Carlyle at some capacity and most certainly maintain the cultural component that's part of that RFP requirement. Thank you so much.
Okay, that is it. We'll bring it back up to the dais. Commissioner Samuelin, your hand is up. Yes. Everyone keep in mind that the staff is not in a position right now to recommend anything. They're still in negotiations and discussions. So I think it's just an update.
Absolutely. So I'll be brief, Mr. Chair. This is clearly a very critical decision that we're going to be facing. Strong views from a number of residents, of course. We've also sort of made a commitment to arts and culture, and Byron Carlyle is one of the key elements of what we have in North Beach. I just want to underline, and I'm so happy to hear that we have CBRE helping us, because the commission did back in June of 2019 pass a resolution requiring that when we deal with public land of this sort, that we have an independent economic analysis, as we are the finance group. Not surprising that that's on my mind. So I do believe it's very important that CBRE do that work per our June 2019 resolution. That's all I have, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Yeah, thank you. And we'll look forward to hearing updates, hopefully at the next meeting. You know, for folks who, you know, and I, for one, enjoy the Byron Carlisle, have many cherished memories there going back, you know, 20 some years. I think there's an important distinction to be made, you know, with historic preservation and preserving a building, because the building is important versus our emotional attachment to the memories that came out of a building. The building itself may not be important. What happened in the building is more important. And I think, at least for me, what I'd like to see done there is a better project being built that has as its centerpiece a cultural component, so that we can restore a cultural asset for our community that can create future memories for future generations. And this is not to destroy a cultural asset, but basically to rebuild something even better in its place that would have as an additional component and an additional public benefit, affordable housing. I don't think personally the building itself at the Byron Carlisle is in any way architecturally significant. What's significant are all the cherished memories that we've had there. And so I just think folks need to disconnect the two in terms of trying to preserve a building versus trying to, you know, restore the opportunities to have a community gathering place, enjoy arts and culture, and, you know, create memories for ourselves. We are challenged as a city with this current property in its current condition to invest upwards of $3 million to restore the property, or take the opportunity to do something even better at no cost to taxpayers. So that's what we're trying to figure out. I think we're all on the same page as to the end goal of having a meaningful cultural asset for the North Beach community and the Miami Beach community at large. At least that's how I feel. Okay, we are deferring item 4, 5. We've got item 6. Let me ask a question, because this is regarding just a discussion item on streamlining things like our business permitting process and improving business retention and attracting new business. This is going to be a front burner issue for our city. I know we recently hired our new economic development officer. I don't know that she has started. Are we better off waiting for her to start so she can provide this update? Or do you want to take this up now, Eric?
I would prefer that we wait till she starts. But obviously the memo is there and can show, you know, basically give you a highlight of some of the activities of the department over the past few months since the last update. And obviously if there's any questions, I'll be happy to answer them.
Yeah, colleagues, I mean, I said what's on my mind on this item is, you know, as we try to restart our economy in the coming months and years, this is going to be as important as anything that we do, including resiliency. I think we need to, you know, provide some guidance to the team as to what kind of businesses and industries, as well as incentives, we're prepared as a city to explore in order to diversify and strengthen our economy. There was an article today in Bloomberg talking about the number of private equity and hedge funds that are literally the headline says it's moving to Florida, and literally said Miami, Miami Beach. But I don't know that we're doing anything proactively to go court these folks. And, you know, I for one think that it's a great opportunity for us to do that and diversify away from, you know, the tourism and hospitality industries. But we could take this up at our next meeting when she starts. I think she's going to start in October.
She starts on Monday.
On Monday. Okay, great.
I agree with you, Chair. Let's take it up, because I think what could happen before the next meeting is after she starts, we could have an opportunity to meet with her individually and talk about, you know, things that are important to us. And maybe she can focus on some of those topics when we have a presentation with her included.
Okay. From our staff, Amy Mayhew has her hand up. Amy, did you want to add something? You're on mute, Amy.
Oh, yep. No worries. You guys were wrapping up the conversation. I know we're on a bit of a time crunch, so it's not biggie. Okay. I was just, no worries.
Let's do item, and we're going to defer item number 11 for folks that were waiting for that. Item number 10, this is a discussion regarding programming in the Normandy Fountain Plaza. Who wants to present this? Is that Amy?
I believe it's Heather Shaw.
Okay, Heather. And oh, I see Marcia. Marcia has her hand up. Or she did. Marcia?
Good afternoon, Chair. I'm sorry, did you want to?
No, I said hi.
Oh, hi. Good afternoon, Chair and Vice Mayor and Commissioners. Heather Shaw, Assistant Director of Tourism and Culture. So I'm presenting, this was an item that Commissioner Ariola referred to us regarding the Normandy Fountain about doing programming in North Beach and the amount of budget that we have for that area. So in the memo, you see what we have done in 1920. I also added a deck of all the activities that we did in 19. We had engaged a company to help us, PRISM, to help do that. We're not engaged with them now. So right now we have about $50,000 in our budget to do programming for the remainder of the year. And we have, and I've also listed the other funding that we were doing in North Beach to promote art and culture in the neighborhood.
Thank you. Daniel Vaisha, you're on deck. And sorry, hang on, colleagues. Commissioner Richardson, you have
Go ahead. Let's hear from the public. Thank you, Chair.
Daniel, you're on.
Thank you, Commissioners. I sent the email earlier kind of recapping the situation. We have spoken to commissioners about our desire as a Normandy Fountain Business Association to program the fountain as we did in the previous cycle. We are committing our own funds as well in addition to what the city can provide. My concern is more where the budget funds are coming from and the fact that they're being removed from what was previously dedicated to the Bandshell. I know the city is committed to citywide cultural programming, but in reality, there's really only two active areas where we can engage and develop, engage in business development activities, and that's the Bandshell and the Fountain. And given how much economic development help North Beach needs, I feel it's prudent to support a budget request to program both the North Beach social events happening at the Bandshell and also support the Normandy Fountain Business Association to continue its efforts to help in business development activities here in the Normandy Fountain. Thank you.
Okay, Commissioner Richardson, you had your hand up first. I'm sorry, hang on to somebody. Oh, James Quinlan is in the audience, then Paula King. Okay.
Thank you, Chairman and Commissioners. I appreciate the opportunity. And we're very supportive of programming at the Normandy Fountain. We got a chance to start working together with them, coordinating programs, coordinating marketing when we both responded to the RFP that came out of the Old Food Truck and Music Festival. We initiated a monthly event at the Bandshell called the North Beach Social, which had a chance to get its proof of concept going, and I think was really well received by the merchants and residents of the community, and has great possibilities to continue as a monthly event tied to the culture crawl on the third Thursdays. We would like to continue that as part of this effort and also coordinate with activities at the fountain.
Thank you. Paula?
Hi, Ricky. How are you?
Good. How are you doing?
I would like to mention a new cultural venue that we have in North Beach, which is the small amphitheater in the Altos del Mar Park. I think we're having some problems there currently with, some loiterers, shall we say. A lot of homeless people are hanging out there. And if we were to activate that in some way, culturally, I think this might be part of the solution to what's happening there now. I'd like to see some sort of a I don't know whether it's folk music or whatever, but I would like to see some sort of entertainment happening there as well, acoustically.
Excellent idea. I support that personally. We'll try to keep it on the Normandy Fountain for today, but I like that idea personally, Paula, and we can explore that once we're back to normal, hopefully sometime soon, where we can gather together and enjoy our great assets here in Miami Beach, including that amphitheater that, you know, unfortunately we opened shortly before the lockdown, but that part of the design is for performances and things like that. Okay, Commissioner Richardson, you had your hand up.
Thank you. Heather, I think you said we have 50,000 left this year. Does that mean this fiscal year, or we've this money is budgeted in the next fiscal year? Maybe between you and John, you can tell me what it's budgeted for.
We have $50,000 in programming for North Beach for fiscal year 2021.
Okay, so it's budgeted.
And that's for just programming. And then we're producing the July 4th event in the Banshell Beach Bowl. And then we also have Culture Crawl.
Okay, so it's $50,000 left of the total that we're budgeting for North Beach. Is that what, for the next fiscal year?
Yes.
John, is that what you have in the budget? I want to make sure we're all in agreement on where this money's at.
Yes, we're in agreement.
Okay, great. So, colleagues, I've been thinking for quite a while about having a little bit more structure on some of the funds that we're giving to neighborhood associations and so forth. So I'm planning on bringing an item in October so we can have a conversation. But I am fully supportive of taking an amount up to $50,000 and allocating it to the Normandy Fountain Business Association for activations that would be approved by the City Commission. I am very, very much supportive of having organizations do some sort of matching, and I know they've been raising some private funds, and that's part of the item that I want to bring in October to have a conversation, because one of the things I've seen in the short time that I've been with the city is that some neighborhood associations maybe get a little bit more money than others, and there are different arrangements made. And so I'd like to at least offer some more consistency, but I'm fully supportive of this item, and I would recommend that we earmark it in our budget for next year for the Normandy Fountain Business Association for activities around the fountain.
Okay. Mark, do you have anything to add?
I'm comfortable with that today for the 50,000.
So
can I just word? I would say up to 50,000, right? Because we're going to ask them for a proposal, and it may be that we want to give them 30,000 and ask them to raise 20,000, or we may want to give them 40. This is part of the item that I want to bring in October, talking about structure for these types of arrangements.
No, I'm glad you're going to do that. So here's what I struggle with not just this request, but anything like it, which is, first of all, the 50,000 I think is well worth it. We've made $1 million+ investment in building out the plaza. That was something I championed and supported. So it needs money, programming, activation, must happen. I think the thing I'm concerned with, not just here, but at any place in the city when we're handing over money to a group, is, you know, for programming, you know, who is the group? How are they going to spend the money? And in this particular case, we happen to know these individuals, and I have them in extremely high regard. But, you know, sometimes in a business community group, you know, we get turnover money, and then maybe there's accusations that group spends the money to promote their own individual business and not the businesses that are part of the, you know, larger district, those kinds of things, or they spend money on their husband or wife's marketing firm. You know, how do we audit and control those kinds of situations, because we don't want to be in that situation. We don't want to put our residents in that situation. And so if you're going to bring this back, Commissioner Richardson, I'd love to hear how we can have things so we keep everything at arm's length and just prevent accusations from one business group against another business group, neighbor to neighbor, this nonsense that we see all the time. And I worry about some of the folks that want to take this on. I didn't speak to them, but be careful what you're asking for, because you might be opening yourself up to all the silliness we see on social media and stuff. And, you know, I want to protect people from that. And sometimes
you're spot on. You raise good points, and we don't want that sort of thing, which is why I've been thinking about this since December, actually. And actually had some really good conversations with Bo Martinez before he left about some thoughts I had. And he actually gave me a couple of good ideas, and I've been percolating them in my brain for almost 10 months, but I want to bring an item so we can talk about it. Maybe it'll be the will of the commission that we want to put some things in writing, but I certainly feel like we need a little bit more structure. But you're good points.
Let me ask you though, what would we be committing to today, John? Just the money, not necessarily who gets it? The $50,000 for programming, or are we committing to giving this money to that business association? Is that a question for you, Heather?
Well, what I wanted to say was that the $50,000 is already in our budget.
Okay.
Once it gets approved, once budget is approved, then we have the $50,000 in our budget for 2021. And also, we always, you know, even with the $50,000 that we have and the programming that we're going to do in North Beach is committed to North Beach. Any programming that we do it in consultation with the business association, their neighbor, the community association. We want to make sure that the community wants what we're doing and understands it. And if they have great ideas, we're always, you know, more than welcome to support and welcome those and support that as well. The end is that $50,000 does what that neighborhood needs. Elevate it, promote it, do programming that is family friendly, business promoting, visitor attracting. So that's our purpose. So we're happy to work with the business association to, you know, with their ideas and support them. But the money is already there to do that.
Okay, thank you. Members of the public, we're not going to take any more public comment. We're going to conclude this and just move on. Okay.
So, Chair, I would say the money is there. And so I mentioned the Normandy Fountain Business Association, and I wasn't specifically going to earmark $50,000 and give that to them. What I was saying is that up to $50,000, but we can leave it general to say the activities for the Normandy Fountain Plaza, the area. But I think that I want to allow the Normandy Fountain Business Association to be able to participate by giving us proposals, because I've had several conversations with them, and I think they know how I feel that I like this idea of partnering with communities, which is part of what I want to bring in October, because I've got some ideas on how I want to structure some financial plans that, you know, if they bring an idea of $5,000, maybe we split it with them and so forth, and we approve the proposal. But I want to make sure that they're included in the process and they're invited to participate. And that's why I'm expressing it the way I am.
Okay, gotcha. Okay. Are we good?
I think we are. Does anyone need anything from the administration?
I'm just looking at John because it's money, and I want to make sure he's good and Heather are good.
Yeah, we're good because the money's already been budgeted for. It's just a question of how to allocate it in practice.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And I think Commissioner Richardson summarized it, and I support it. Okay. Okay, we're almost done with items 9 and 12, I think. That's it. Item number 9 is something I brought up. Hopefully you all find it interesting, which is discuss establishing an artistic utility box wrap program. I don't know if you had an opportunity to look at your supplemental, which had some artistic renderings, you know, just up in the next county, some things that you could do very cheaply, quickly, to beautify our city and also beautify things that are typically ugly, such as utility boxes, whether they're painted or wrapped. Sometimes you can get this donated. You know, there's plenty of artists who'll do it for free or very little money. Sometimes you can even, you know, get a sponsor to pick it up. Since this is finance and involves the expenditure of some money, I wanted to see if you guys had an appetite for doing something like this.
Commissioner, can I? Yeah, before you get on with this item, I just wanted to bring up that this item had been brought forward to the commission twice before by Commissioner Steinberg and once by Commissioner Malakoff. So I'd like to let you know that I'd like to make that change in the memo moving forward when it goes to commission. And as such, Commissioner Steinberg has asked if you would agree to her, let her be a co-sponsor with you on this item.
Yeah, 100%. What's the history of that? Did it not go anywhere when they brought it up? What did we do in the past?
Commissioner, give me one second. I have it on an email here. But in the past, it didn't go forward because there was so many different kinds of different entities that oversee the utility boxes. I think in Heather's proposal, she's talking about the boxes, our traffic boxes. And so we're leaving out the FPNL boxes or the telecom type boxes. It's solely our traffic boxes. And so we have the ability to do that on our boxes.
Okay. Commissioner Richardson, your hand is up from before or for now? From before, okay.
Thank you, sir.
Okay. Do we have a budget for this? I mean, in terms of a dollar figure?
Based on the research in the past, it was $35,000 that the county did as an example for 20 boxes, and it was budgeted at $1,750 per box.
And how many boxes do we have in the city?
We have 248.
Wow. Hmm. That we control.
Yes, the traffic boxes.
I mean, so then, yeah, if we did all of them, obviously it'd get very expensive.
I would think that if we do them, we would probably do them strategically and do them in a cluster so people can feel like they can walk by and see it, or at high traffic intersections that would be more noticeable, but we would be more strategic and not just do all of them or be cost efficient about it.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of things like that. That's an idea. The other one is, you know, getting sponsors or volunteers to do it for even less money. There would have to be a mechanism in place if we want to put ourselves in a path to do something approaching 200. Doing 30 boxes is, you know, easy. So what do we need to do today? If there's an appetite from my colleagues, I see both your hands up. If you're so inclined, then we just set aside some money, assuming John says we can find that money, or we just table this. Commissioner Samuelin, you had your hand up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I like the concept. I think anything we can do to improve our aesthetic environment is really, really good. You know, one of the things that hits me is that we have a lot of folks with aesthetic taste in this community. Probably locking on a design is not going to be a trivial angle. At the same time, we are having some difficult budget conversations. You know, we're dealing with furloughs and we're dealing with some very difficult issues in this current budget, which I believe we're going to approve, hopefully, on Tuesday. So I like it, would like to be supportive. Perhaps one option to the sponsor would be that we, you know, sort of align around this, that we want to do it, that we start down the process of getting a design, that we start down the process of, you know, prioritizing which boxes. You know, if John's got the money today, that would be amazing. But if not, the alternative is that it rolls into next year's budget cycle.
Commissioner Richardson.
Thank you, Chair. I like the idea a lot. I'm worried a little bit about the funds, especially in our current situation. And I'm just wondering if there's any way that at $17.50, there's a way to do them cheaper. The other thing is I wonder about if we identified like 20 boxes or 10 boxes, how many, and had a contest, if we allowed a different artist. You know how years ago people painted the flamingo or the whatever the, and then in some cities they were painting cows and so forth. And then they had a contest and then maybe we could set a prize for first place, second place, and third place and let the community vote on design and have 20 different artists do something with them. I don't know if they can be painted or if they have to be wrapped because of the mechanic. They could be painted, then we could let artists do a conceptual and then we could review it to make sure there wasn't anything that would be objectionable to the community. But we could do it that way and have a contest and it wouldn't cost the city anything really, except for maybe some prize money, but we could probably raise that prize money from third parties. But I love the idea, but I'm a little worried about spending the money for this right now.
Okay, then let's move on. Let's not do anything with it. Let's do number 12.
That's me too. Thank you. Very excited to present to you finally that we have that the award for the Carl Fisher Clubhouse was awarded to Centerplate, who is our F&B service provider for the Convention Center. And so they will be extending to also take on our Carl Fisher Clubhouse and Annex, which should be a wonderful extension to what we can offer for the Convention Center, as well as being something that is wonderful for the community. What I present, I'm also joined, Raphael has been involved with us, as well as Doug Connor and Danny Mendina and Steve Haas. I think they are on the call as well, listening to the conversation. So what I wanted to go over per the commission, and it was awarded in the July 2020 commission, and the terms of the agreement were presented to the, referred to the finance committee. So the conditions of the agreement, which is that we have generally come into mutual agreement with Centerplate, are within the item. One is the financial, if you'd like me to go through all of them. We have a new management fee of 4% of the gross revenue and a profit sharing distribution of 83.17. The reason why we changed this means that the Centerplate takes on more of the risk to make sure that this becomes a very productive and efficiently run operation, whether it is an extension of the clients that we have in the Convention Center or the standalone doing programming for the residents and our visitors. Two, they've asked for an extension of the contract terms. Currently, their existing contract with the Convention Center expires in the end of September of 2022, and they are putting in up to $750,000 capital improvement into the buildings. And so they would like that to be amortized over 5 years and have asked for an extension of their agreement to 2025. Based on the existing agreement that we have, they had an extension of their agreement based on items that were in the agreement with respect to the completion of the building. They also are going to do a pro forma, and one of the things they're also doing is they're going to include local chefs and get named chefs to come to be an attraction for the venue, and they are going to engage in sustainability measures and obviously COVID measures since we've been going through that. They will continue to do emergency catering when we have emergencies and hurricane emergencies, as well as do public benefit programs. Like I said, they're very engaged. And if you have any questions, I'm happy to answer them. And then, as I mentioned, Doug Connor and Danny Medina and Steve Haas are also on the line to answer any questions.
Heather, what commitments, I don't think I heard you say, but what commitments do we have from them on staying open and programming on non-convention center nights? So if there's not a convention in town and the conventioners haven't booked the venue, will they open up service so that, you know, just residents can go have dinner there?
Right. So we want the convention center clients to have first, you know, right of first refusal. So if someone wants to take, like if Art Basel comes in and they want to take over the Carl Fisher and everything, then we close it down. But all of those measures are done in mutual agreement with the city. So we work with them on their marketing, on their schedule, on their menus, all of that. We all work together to get that done, to make sure. And so if it has to close down for the convention center, it will, but that's part of the agreement that they maintain it open to the public when it is not engaged otherwise. Now they will also do private, as part of the social catering, they'll do weddings, right, private parties, that type of thing.
But I mean, yeah, so you a little bit answered my question, but not fully, because conventions we know well in advance when they're being booked. So they've got a calendar. So they know, you know, when they're dark and when they're open. So they'll know when they're dark,
yes,
to open. So is there a firm commitment from them to run it as a restaurant or venue, yes, when they're, it's not booked?
Yes. Yes, it is.
It is.
Yes.
Here, I think you said, is there somebody from CenterPlate? Because I would like to hear from them directly on this, you know, on your question.
Yeah, Doug.
Because I'm kind of curious what their plans are. I'd love to hear from them on this.
Yeah, because
so, Commissioner, it's Doug Connor.
Yeah, all right, Doug, go ahead.
So the intent is, because the Carl Fisher is in two pieces, the piece that's closest to Washington Avenue, the intent is to have that as an a la carte restaurant as much as humanly possible, in addition to programming Sunday brunch and weddings and social business on the piece that is not adjacent to the Washington Avenue, okay? What we forecast is that the convention center business is primarily going to use the piece of the Carl Fisher that is set further back from the Washington Avenue. So that leaves us to the front piece that can be done for the local chef pop-ups, the celebrity events that go on there, and then be open to the public. Just like you would an a la carte restaurant, there is a plan for that. We have already engaged 4 or 5 local known chefs to participate with it. We have agreements from them to participate with us on those events. So it's a very community friendly concept with the piece of the Carl Fisher that is closest to Washington. Hopefully that helps a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, look, my feeling is it's a community assets, publicly owned building. I, for one, would like the public to enjoy it. So if it's only available to conventioneers and conventions aren't open to the public for the most part, you know, some you can buy tickets for, but most are, you know, closed, you know, pharmaceutical convention, you can't go participate unless you're in the industry. So, you know, you could have a situation where 300 days a year, that building is completely closed off to the public because of convention center business. I would like to see it made available to the public on non-convention events, assuming they didn't book it. And, you know, I really want that commitment so that the public can enjoy what's one of our most historic buildings, and that the public put, you know, a lot of taxpayer dollars to rehabilitate, and that it's not just used for private events. That's my feeling. I'd love to hear my colleagues' view on that. Doug, you were going to say something?
Yeah, no, we understood that concern. You know, we've been talking about this for the better part of 2 years, and in our, we're working on a draft agreement pending your approval. But even in the draft agreement, we've outlined the things that I've just shared with you so that it's part and parcel of the agreement that CenterPlate has, as with the city. In addition, there is language in there for the facility to be used for community events with no charge. There's also a provision in there for the facility to be used in the event of citywide or national catastrophe, whether that's a hurricane or COVID or whatever that happens to be. So all of these provisions are addressed in the draft agreement because we listened to what you all said the last time, and that's exactly what we've worked out with Heather.
Great. Paula King, you have your hand up. I don't know if that's a holdover. Paula, are you on? Paula? She may have not disconnected. Okay. Colleagues, Commissioner Samuelin, you have your hand up, and then Rafael Paz has his hand up, and then Commissioner Richardson. Rafael, would you like to go? First, Mark?
Oh. No, I'd like to hear Rafael first, and then I'll be happy to speak.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So just to be clear that what is proposed here is an amendment to CenterPlate's existing concession agreement for the convention center. So when the memo mentions they want the contract term to be coterminous, is that they want the Carl Fisher services to extend through 2025, which is reasonable because of the $750,000 contribution. But what you would be approving is an extension of the overall agreement for all of the concession services for the convention center and the Carl Fisher. So just to make clear that that's what's before you in terms of the extension of the term.
Okay, thank you for that. Yeah, so it's not just Carl Fisher, it's keeping CenterPlate through 2025 as the official concessionaire of the convention center itself. We didn't really discuss that. I mean, I've got my opinion. I'm very happy with what I've seen in the short amount of time we've been open from CenterPlate. But in terms of, it's a big contract, it's a big commitment. Do we feel comfortable doing that, or should we at some point go to an RFP now that we're fully open at the convention center?
And just for clarity, and Rafael, correct me if I'm wrong, but again, their existing agreement ends on September 2022. And because of a clause with respect to reopening and the getting the TCO for the building, the end term would be somewhere in 2024. Am I correct, Rafael? So the extension.
I haven't reviewed that issue of what extensions they would be entitled to, but I think that sounds correct. That there are provisions in the existing concession agreement that could provide for an extension of the term. But I thought it was just for the if the convention center was not completed, and it is. But we can look at that separately. It's just what is before you. I just want to just highlight so that it, you know, not that it's an issue, just so that you're aware.
Yeah, thank you. And I hate to, I mean, it's a big contract. It's a strategic decision that we have to make on, you know, who's going to be providing these services. And I don't want to do something because we're thinking about Carl Fisher Clubhouse, which is small, and then, you know, extend a contract that's big because we didn't have our eye on the ball. So could you confirm that for our full commission meeting when we go for approval of this, Rafael, just to make sure we understand? I mean, I've got a personal viewpoint in terms of fairness and equity, and I don't know what the contract says, but they've barely been able to operate at full steam. You know, COVID's kept them closed for 6 months, and, you know, we've had storm events and lots of things that have prevented the convention center from truly being open for an extended period of time. But that's just my personal view, and my colleagues have their hands up.
Yep. Mr. Chair, if I may, thank you. And CenterPlate is a strong, you know, large organization. As you said, the relationship has been a little bit, you know, abbreviated, but it appears like, and I'm reading, the city is recommending that we proceed. So directionally, I'm comfortable. I want to make 2 points. First, I think you made an excellent point about activation for the community. On the follow-up, I think Heather gave a very short, succinct answer. Yes. So I like that answer, and I want to see that in writing. I want to see that that's absolutely clear that this is going to be a community amenity, not just when the convention center is open. The second thing is while we can always get a little more on the financial terms, and you know, I would like that, to me, the bigger issue is that this new location be successful. And so my question is, what if it isn't? What are the exit terms? You know, I'd hate to see that vacant. So I'd love to hear from the city administration or city attorney's office of what happens if this is not working and our ability to exit a non-functioning agreement, leaving something vacant again.
Mark, thank you for that. That's something that I had brought up way back and didn't remember to do that today, but it's a great point. And yeah, Raphael, that's a really excellent point. I'll share with you a personal anecdote. And Commissioner Richardson, I know you're waiting. As you know, I was chair of the Arch Center for many years, you know, a decade ago. And when that building opened, the food and beverage services were run by a very large organization, not unlike Centerplate. And Centerplate, I don't even know if they own them, but I think it was called Levy, the Levy Group. Huge, they run stadiums and things like that. And they had the concession, the master concession. And I wanted to open a restaurant inside the Arch, and they told me couldn't be done, it would fail. So I fired them because they just, you know, and of course we opened a restaurant. We've opened a succession of restaurants uninterrupted for the past 12 years. Right now we've got a James Beard award winning chef running the restaurant there, but you know, you get these large restaurant groups that specialize in one thing. They take on an asset like this, a smaller venue that's important as a city, and maybe they don't pay enough attention to it. And then it's lackluster and it's mothballed for 5 years. And they say, well, you know, we can't program it successfully for you. So I would want an out clause that would allow us to take it back if, in our opinion, they're not truly activating it and using it, so that we could then maybe hand it over to a proprietor who would nurture it in the appropriate way. So I thank you for reminding me of that, Commissioner Samuel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That's all for me.
Commissioner Richardson.
Thank you, Chair. Question, does the current contract have any option years on it so that the parties can exercise options? Or
this is the last one. The current contract for the Convention Center expires in 22, subject to whatever equitable adjustment for.
But there's no option after that that's in the current contract?
Yeah.
Okay. I got it. So, I too am really interested in activation. I think they have a great plan now that includes food and entertainment, but also the opportunity for the community to use the space when it's not being used by the convention. I fully support that it be part of the Convention Center campus. I think it's a great asset that can be offered to folks coming into town. So I love that it's going to be part of the overall campus. I do think that we ought to look at whether or not them sort of out provision on one or both of the buildings in the event that it doesn't work out for whatever reason. And, you know, I think that the we should take this to the commission on the extension of the term. You know, I'm comfortable with that at this point. But I think that's a decision that the full commission would have to make. So, but I'm fully supportive of moving this forward.
Okay, wonderful. So by acclamation, I think we all agree. Okay. Folks, I think that concludes today's meeting. I think we covered all of the agenda items. You can check me on that. Am I right?
Yes.
Okay. Well, pleasure spending the afternoon with you all, and I'll see you all soon.
Pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you.